Tony Award-winning director and choreographer, Casey Nikoloff, Australian singer-songwriter, Casey Chambers, and another round of the best worst movies of all time. And now, here's your host, a man who is thinking capri pants for the rest of the summer, Justin Kaufman.
Who doesn't love the capri pants, right? I mean, an 89-degree day, and I'm okay with it. I am definitely okay with it. Welcome to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. What a beautiful night in Chicago. It continues. Woo! 89 degrees, but you know what? It's a good heat. Isn't that the saying, Pete? I think that's the Chicago. And I know dry heat is, and it's a wet heat is the East Coast, and red heat is Russia. So I do think a good heat, right?
That seems appropriate.
It's appropriate, yeah. But it's great. You're looking at Michigan Avenue right now, live in Chicago. Beautiful people walking up and down. It is a great night here, and I'm glad to be with you. Till 11 o'clock coming up, Patty Vasquez is going to join us. She's in Springfield. She's live tonight from Springfield after a huge historic day. I guess it's historic. I don't know if it's actually historic. The idea that you say it's historic because they did what they're supposed to do. I think it's more historic the budget impasse for 2 years. Actually, voting on a budget is not really historic. I mean, that's pretty accurate.
Yeah, tricking people into thinking that you've done something grand when really you're just doing your job.
Right. Barely doing your weird. Job. We'll talk with Patty. She's been down there. We'll get reacts today. Huge budget vote. The House overrides the governor's veto, and we finally have a budget in the state of Illinois after 2 years without one. But if you talk about the political fallout, it could be that Republicans believe that the Democrats didn't change at all in the 2 years during this stalemate. And Democrats say that this really shouldn't have happened in the first place, that Republicans were trying to, specific to Governor Rauner, just trying to break the system. And he essentially came close. It's kind of like when you try to break a credit card and you just fold it back and forth, and you fold it back and forth, and you try to rip it right down the middle, and you can't because of plastic, and it's got that little white line right in the middle. That's the state of Illinois right now. They were not successful in ripping the credit card, but it's definitely folded with that white crease in the middle. Try using that at Target.
Rendered mostly useless.
Mostly useless. I think that's the new tourism slogan. Rendered mostly useless. So that's coming up. Also tonight, the download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. We'll have that coming up at 7:30, where we'll talk about investments, capital, and the film and television industry here in Chicago. Also coming up at 8 o'clock tonight, Australian singer-songwriter Casey Chambers. She's got a new album out, just came through Chicago. She will be in studio. She'll perform live. Also coming up at 9 o'clock tonight, Broadway superstar, director, choreographer, Tony Award winner Casey Nikoloff. Casey Nikoloff is the director of Something Rotten, which will be starting on, I wouldn't say on Randolph. I want to say on Broadway, but it's on Randolph here in Chicago, Broadway in Chicago, at the Oriental Theater coming up on the 11th. Casey Nikoloff will join us to talk about his great career. Amazing. I mentioned a row. The credits include Spamalot, Book of Mormon, Aladdin, Dreamgirls, Something Rotten. And it's an amazing amount of work, and he's won 6 Tonys, not just for his work as directing, but for choreography as well. And then coming up tonight at 10 o'clock, we will continue our series with the Neo-Futurists, the best worst movies of all time. This is something I'm very excited about. We've had three great segments, and we've come up with three winners. It's a great game where you just have to text in or call in with your suggestion for the best worst movie of all time, and you could win a prize. And it gets into the big tournament, which right now includes Bad Ronald, which is about a kid who gets caught in the walls of his house, and they forget he's there, and then he just kind of like peeks in on the new family. Rabbit Test, which is a late 70s comedy starring a pregnant Billy Crystal. Tiptoes, which I'm not even sure how to explain this one. Tiptoes is a little people adventure starring Gary Oldman and others who are acting like they're little people. I think that's, did I come close? I came close. Might be medieval, I'm not sure. It's somewhere in there. So those are the first three. We'll have another best bad movie tonight here on The Download. All right, news, weather, and traffic. It's Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, coming up, Patty Vasquez. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. What a day in Springfield. The state of Illinois has a budget. After a veto by the governor on the 4th of July, the House overrode the veto with 71 votes. A day, I venture to say it's not historic, but a day in Springfield history. We'll put that as it ends a two-year impasse. An amazing, amazing special session, and Patty Vasquez was there for most of it. She, of course, is the host of Pretty Late and a correspondent here at WGN Radio for Springfield, and she's down there for most of the sessions. Patty, thanks for joining us. What a day in Springfield. Oof. An amazing day. Yes. Talk about did they feel like, what was the reaction of the lawmakers when they got to the point where a budget was actually passed?
Oh, there was no fanfare. It was very quiet. The votes were cast. There were three rounds of voting because there are three components to the budget. The revenue was first, which is the most, that's actually obviously the most controversial. People are really worried. They're concerned about their paychecks. They want to know what this is going to cost them. And there were 14 Republicans that stood to speak. The Democrats, for the most part, did not speak. And there were Republicans that were for and against, like Representative David Harris, who said this is not, there is no joy today. This is not, I do not want to vote for higher taxes, but I do not want my state to fall off the cliff. And Representative Anderson also was very passionate about how, we need to do this to fight another day, meaning, when we talk about these taxes and when it goes into the budget, it is called the permanent tax, but every budget, any budget along the way where we're back on our feet, they can do this and lower the taxes. Mm-hmm. But we have to get that's what they're saying, is that we have to get our state back on track. And then Representative Cabello, Representative Butler got up to speak and were very passionate about how this is not the budget they want. This is not the compromise they were seeking, and that they wanted to, represent their district and their constituents and their concerns. The Democrats didn't give many speeches. I think there was a big concern that if they were caustic or kind of attacked the Republicans that were not voting for this, they might lose some votes. Because there was a little bit of a heat on the floor on Sunday. There was a little contentious. So go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask. I mean, Governor Rauner publicly said that he was pushing lawmakers to not override this veto. He fell short, of course, as Republicans voted and went across the aisle to vote to get to the minimum 71 votes. Could you feel that? I mean, what was the reaction to the idea that the governor himself went public saying he didn't want the lawmakers to do it and they did it anyway?
Well, four Republicans who had originally voted for the budget, for this version of the budget, in particular the revenue, they voted no this time around. And there was one, Representative Pritchard, who actually had voted yes on revenue, apparently is on vacation in Russia, so he was not present for the vote. Mm. But so there were five that originally had voted for the budget, which when those votes didn't go up, there were several Democrats who originally had also voted no, by the way, to the revenue the first time around. And I believe it seemed as though, knowing they would be short, those Democrats then voted for the revenue bill portion this time.
Are the Republicans who voted the 10 or so votes that came in, I mean, do they worry about the governor putting a primary challenge in or doing something to unseat them as representatives in the House?
What I'm being told by some people, well, some have already announced that they either aren't running. Like Representative Hayes has said that he will not be running again, and he had voted yes on this, and he made that announcement on, I believe, on Monday, and I think as some of the legislators believe you're going to hear more people say, I came here, I did as much as I could, I'm done. I think others are worried. They made it part of their speeches on Sunday, the original vote on the budget. They said, I might be primaried, and that's weird to me. To kind of throw it out there as part of I'm going to do this even though I'm primary. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us want our legislators to do their job regardless of what the next election is going to be. Right. That's not our concern about whether or not you'll be primaried. We should be your concern. The people who are working on the roads who are getting laid off this week, that should be your concern. The disabled, the elderly, education in the state. A lot of people don't want to hear about whether or not they'll be primary, but obviously it's a big concern. And for the Democrats, too. A lot of Democrats didn't vote for revenue because they didn't want them to be on the flyers. You know, so-and-so raised your taxes. So, yeah, that's a lot of how this went down. But
how is this going to be spun? Because Governor Rauner, of course, vetoed the bill. So he has on, you know, as he gets ready for an election season where he could say he didn't that none of the reforms came through. And this is just the Democrats once again putting reckless government forward. How do you see this being spun from the Republican side, even though there seemed to be some movement that this was going to be much more bipartisan, or these were some of the issues that Republicans had thought about when putting a budget idea forward in the first place?
Right. Well, and I think that, you know, they raised your taxes there's nothing bigger than that. There's no bigger campaign slogan than they raised your taxes, right? I think everything else is much more complicated, and including the fact that in January when the governor presented his budget and what he considered a compromise budget, he included a 4.95 income tax, right? And when you ask people, do you want, you know, for pension reform, okay, so do we take pensions away from retired teachers? People are like, oh, no, we don't want to do that. Okay, so should we control the pensions and the agreements we have going forward? Oh, absolutely. That is in this budget. It's a tier 3 reform on the budget, so that the tier 3, meaning going forward in the new negotiations, there's a hybrid. It's a combination 401k style investment and pension combination offsets. These are all, and that's the thing. How do you put that on a flyer, right? There's a tier 3 pension reform in this, and that falls on. It's not easy to convey that message. So I don't know. You know, it's not. We're so far behind. We, you know, in 1994, Governor Edgar decided to change the way we paid for pensions, and here we are. You know, 23 years later.
Patty, you'll have a lot of this on the show tonight. But as we wrap up here, I mean, Chicago comes out a winner. Rahm Emanuel asked for pension relief. He got it. He asked for funding, more funding for the schools. He got it. It seems like Chicago, even though the governor continues with using the word bailout and sort of creating a Chicago versus the rest of us in the state of Illinois, Chicago did win in this budget.
Well, 400,000 school children in Chicago won, right? Chicago shouldn't win for mismanaging the schools. We shouldn't win anything. But the kids who go to school in Chicago, and for people who worry about, you know, where is crime going in Chicago, we want kids to get an education and to, you know, we all want everyone to be a part of the society and be informed and participate. So, the kids in Chicago, I think, are the ones that won as far as that wordage should go.
Patty Vasquez, we'll have plenty of this and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. She's coming back. She'll be in studio tonight. Patty, of course, covers Springfield and has been present in the session this entire month. Patty, thanks so much for checking in with us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking me. I appreciate it. I'll see you in a few hours.
See ya. All right. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Man, what a day.
I know, right?
God, Wimbledon was fantastic. Was there anything else going on? Did I miss something?
And someone texted in 630 said, don't make these guys heroes for passing the budget. These are the same people that have held Illinois hostage.
You know, it's funny. I wouldn't say that lawmakers were holding the state hostage. Obviously, you have two sides that vehemently disagree on things. But I will say that they better temper their backslapping just a bit and just get on with the business of running the state.
I guess
because
for me,
nobody should be congratulated.
Yeah, and I would say, and Patty will have this as well at 11, this concept of, you know, at the end of the day, this is just a budget. It's just a blueprint. There are ideological things on the table, and part of the fight has been, you know, this insistence that the ideological things be in the budget. Now that they got the budget done, now I want to see some of this movement. I do want to have a robust conversation and debate about whether or not some of the reforms that the governor has put forward are good for the state of Illinois. It's just nice to not have it sort of, you know, continually skip deadlines.
Well, I, like a lot of people in the suburbs and downstate, will be watching very closely how they roll out this school reform funding package.
Yeah, right. That's
portion
next,
of the
right.
bill.
That's great.
Because they insist that it's not going to take away from spending in the suburbs and downstate. I don't know if that's true. So we'll see.
630 says, to quote the old comic strip Calvin and Hobbes, life is easier when people have lower expectations of me. That's...
I don't know how much lower they could have gotten in Springfield, really.
All right.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time. I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Ooh, it's business. It's business time.
Thank you, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN, and it's time for the Download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. We usually do this on Tuesdays, but tonight, because of the holiday, get an extra Thursday. It's a weekly segment where we talk shop with Chicago area business owners. Tonight, we turn our attention to the fast-growing entertainment industry here in Chicago. We've heard much about the production companies and major television and films setting up shop in Chicago with places like CineSpace and the continued push by the Illinois Film Office. Chicago's getting work. Since 2011, Illinois production has tripled in size. But with all the content being developed and produced, the industry lags behind New York and Los Angeles when it comes to capital. Yep, it's harder to get financing for independent film and TV projects. And at the end of the day, the investments are what makes the industry move. Enter Chicago Media Angels. They're an investment group that not only finances local projects, but focuses on educating and organizing investors. Ted Riley's the executive director. He's an entrepreneur and investor himself who runs SRH Partners and has run his own film and media companies in the past. Ted, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Pleasure to be here.
All right, so let's talk about this. I mean, I say this, the film industry here in Chicago, and we've heard so much about it, film TV, has tripled in size. Is it accurate to say that really, when you talk about the film industry, it has to include capital, it has to include investment firms and others who are actually or funding the films that we're talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the growth that we've seen in the past 5-6 years in Chicago has been driven by, as you mentioned earlier, the Dick Wolf shows, the big studio films and network television shows coming to town. And that's really great work to help build our industry and, frankly, let professionals set down their roots and stay here. But the next step for most filmmakers is to make their own thing. And the reality is getting that independent film or that new television series developed and financed hasn't been a possibility in Chicago. And we see that as the next natural step in the evolution of the Chicago industry.
Before that, I mean, take us through it, because I've always been intrigued and fascinated by the way that independent film is financed. How do independent filmmakers get funding? I mean, are they going to angel investors? Are they going to business owners and others and say, hey, you know what, I got an opportunity for you?
Absolutely, and that has been the bread and butter of the industry for a long time, and there are a lot of folks who have a great deal of experience doing this on the coast, so in New York or in L.A., there are plenty of film producers who might make a $40 or $50 million film in a year, and then on the side they'll make $1 or $2 million films to try to get that kind of breakout project. And that's just something that we haven't had savvy investors in that space in the Midwest in the past. But there's been tremendous disruption in the industry in the past decade. I mean, I think a lot of people sometimes forget that the iPhone was introduced to us less than a decade ago.
Right.
And when we think about how content is distributed and consumed, that's radically changed, right? So you have new players in the space like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon who are now dominating the content distribution. And those guys don't have the in-house development that, say, an HBO or Showtime might have. And so it's a huge opportunity for independent creators of content to develop their stuff and bring it to these new buyers. But it's been slower to change on the development side. You still see films getting packaged and financed the same way they were 10, 20 years ago. And we see a huge opportunity there. And so that's what we're trying to do at Chicago Media Angels, is really democratize the content creation process and let individuals back projects that they're passionate about. But at the same time, give them the resources and the professional investment management to earn a healthy return on their investment.
Well, take us there. Let's go right there. Let's talk about how do you see Chicago Media Angels moving the investment industry forward, entrepreneurs, and getting people involved more in film production, especially when it comes to capital?
Yeah, so you know, one of the things, and I guess to back up a little bit, my background in working at SRH Partners, we helped raise some capital for a post-production and audio studio in Chicago in 2013 called Periscope Post and Audio. And they're on the lot at CineSpace, and we were really thrilled. At the time, there was 4 network television shows being shot in Chicago, and we were really excited about that revenue. And we went out to the local market, and from local angel investors, we were able to raise roughly $750,000 to build out that business. But promptly, we were kind of jolted by 3 of our 4 network television show clients getting canceled by networks.
Right.
And that's just something that's completely out of our
control. That's part of the business, right.
Exactly. And somebody in L.A. decides they're done with it, and it's done. Now, Periscope was very fortunate that in 2014 there was this little Lee Daniels pilot in town, and the show Empire got ordered by Fox and turned out to do very well. And they recorded all their music at Periscope, and that frankly saved that post house. But that to me and my partners was a real impetus to say we need to do something about cultivating a local ecosystem of content creators. We can't just wait for people from Hollywood to come into Chicago to take advantage of a local tax credit. And at the same time, you'd seen technology really not only disrupt how content gets distributed, but also has driven down the cost of production. And so, you know, films that were made 20 years ago, they would spend $200,000 on physical film and developing the film. And today that's a, you know, that's a hard drive and a digital camera. So the cost has plummeted, and there's an opportunity now for individuals to go back projects and make really great films in the low seven figure space. And in fact, right now in box offices, there's films like Get Out, which was made for, you know, less than $5 million, and it's now grossed close to $250 million.
Does that help you, Ted? Does that help you when you're trying to secure funding and capital here in the Midwest? Does it help you that the cost of an independent film has gone down? Meaning, you know, that that investor who may not have invested in films in the past now is looking at this investment going, oh, that's more manageable than what I knew of the film industry 10, 15, 20 years ago.
I think the cost dropping is important, although that's not the only thing. I think that part of that is actually, I think, the magic sauce of Chicago Media Angels, which is instead of just finding that one trader or banker or lawyer or doctor who could cut a big check, we try to get 100 of those people in the room and then get them all to cut smaller checks. And then, frankly, to each one of those individuals, I'd say, okay, you have an appetite to invest $250,000 in a film. The smart way to do this would be to cut $10,000, $25,000 checks, not one $250,000 check, because it is still a high-risk, high-reward business, similar to venture capital or other angel investments. And so we literally, you know, copied a couple other businesses in Chicago, which had been very successful at getting local investors to step into the sort of tech startup world.
Yeah.
So think like Hyde Park Angels, Irish Angels are two great examples. And we literally took their model and said, let's apply that to content as an asset class. And so by helping the investor diversify across the portfolio, but at the same time, maintain the sort of subjective and aesthetic control on which projects they'd back and invest in, and enable them to pick essentially in their own slate of 10 projects, has given them some diversification. So from an investment perspective, it's less risky. And then two, to your original, you know, to your question, the fact of the matter is we can make a great film for $1 million. So if I can get 100 people to throw 10 grand into the hat, you know, that's $1 million, yeah, and we can make a world-class film with that.
I have questions and follow-ups. And what I want to do is take a quick break just so we stay on time. Ted Riley's the executive director of Chicago Media Angels, entrepreneur, and who's run film houses and production houses in the past. We'll take a quick break here in the Download in Chicago Business. We'll return and continue the conversation. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's a Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. On the line with me, Ted Riley. Ted Riley's the executive director of Chicago Media Angels, an investment group that is really hell-bent on sort of changing the way that films and film and television projects, content in the Chicago area, is financed. We talk about capital, investments, and a lot of things that many of the listeners right now might not be able to wrap their heads around. And I'm one of them. As someone who's even been creative in my life and understand the idea of trying to get someone to invest in your project, to invest in your creativity, to invest in your idea, it's a difficult sell. It's not something that people are just lined up with money in their pockets. Right, Ted?
Well, no, for sure. I'll say this. I think getting people to invest in a great story might be easier than getting them to invest in the next Google. There is a little bit of an advantage of content has so many great reasons, and people like telling great stories. The trick is convincing them that they can get their money back, and I believe they can. But it takes a lot of expertise and experience in the industry and knowing how intellectual property laws work to do that.
Yeah, I mean, Ted, that's the elephant in the room when you talk about investing in film, especially independent film, is that it automatically or it oftentimes falls into the category of a passion play. an investment where you know that, you know, you're not going to get a return on it, but it was great to be involved in making a film or getting into the movie business. How do you debunk that? How do you debunk for investors that and it is about passion only and that you that it's high risk, high reward, and the idea of getting return on your investment is slim?
Well, you know, I think that there's a couple points to that. We get asked a lot of times from prospective investors, are we trying to win awards and get critical acclaim, or are we trying to make money on our investments? And I would argue that those two things are not mutually exclusive. And the reality is if your project gets nominated for an Oscar, it's going to make more money than if it doesn't. So on one hand, I think the passion and having an authentic story is crucial to building a great media property that is a good investment. The flip side is getting your money back means that you need to have a business plan that goes beyond just the last day of post-production. And so kind of a big red flag for us is when somebody comes to us with a project and, you know, needless to say, you hang a shingle, say you've got capital for content, you get a lot of submission.
Yeah, right.
Don't really have that sort of marketability or that understanding of how they're going to sell it and how they're going to monetize it, that's not what we're looking for. We really do want projects that are going to speak to an audience that has been identified and we know how to reach and we know how to monetize. And so that's kind of the crucial piece that we're looking for. But I'd push back on the concept that an authentic, passionate story can't do that. Oftentimes, you need that authentic, passionate story to start with. And I think that that's the opportunity in independent film. Studios, which have, you know, billions of dollars of capital to deploy and they're, you know, run by six major corporations, they are more and more risk averse and less likely to produce those authentic, intelligent films. And I would argue that audiences are really hungry for those. And that's our opportunity to sort of fill that void.
You know, I think about media companies in general, and like you just mentioned, I mean, the idea that you're in competition when you're an independent filmmaker with production houses with a lot of capital, whether it be Sony Pictures or any of those, film houses out in Los Angeles. Those companies not only gobble up content, but they gobble up investment. They gobble up capital. They have great relationships. When we talk about what you guys are doing at Chicago Media Angels, a lot of it is trying to get to people who aren't necessarily already in the game, aren't sort of big fish that are going around dropping hundreds of thousands of dollars on projects, whether it be independent or through the movie system.
Yeah, so to that point, that's a double-edged sword. You know, giant capital, the more you put into the film, the harder it is to get your money out. And if you put $60 million into a movie, you've got a much higher bar to be profitable than if you put $1 million into your movie.
Right, right.
And so, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the streaming platforms such as Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, and many others, YouTube stepping into the game, Apple stepping into the game, those guys, you know, they can come in and take out a property at $1 million. Well, if you spent $50 million making your movie, $1 million check is not that great. If you made a movie for $1 million, that can be an awesome outcome or at least a good outcome. So that's a big part of it. I think people forget when you walk into a movie theater, the ticket costs the same amount regardless of the budget to produce that film. And then what we find at Chicago Media Angels is there are a number of really experienced, excellent producers who have made $40, $50 million movies in the studio system. And they're coming to us and they'd say, I've got a picture that's been greenlit by Sony for $20 million, but I'd rather make it with you guys for $7 million. And they do it with that because we give them a lot more freedom, a lot more ability to tell their authentic story the way they want to cast it the way they want to. And you'll see great talent, A-list actors who, you know, if they're working on a movie that Sony's making, they're going to have a pretty stiff list of demands of what they need to get paid to do that. Whereas if there's a really great authentic project where they're in love with the material, they'll come do it at a much lower pay rate. And that's what we seek to exploit. By giving the artists the freedom and the ability to tell an authentic story, we believe we can make a product that would cost Sony $20 million to make. We think we can make that same product, exact same thing, for $3, $4 million. And again, that's our opportunity.
Yeah, and you don't think about it that way, but that, I mean, not unlike we're talking about You know, the idea of shipping, or whether it be coffee or whatever. We do a lot of different segments here on the Download in Chicago Business. But the same concept, you have found a way to be able to finance projects that used to be more money for less.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the actors would rather work in our environment than work in the Hollywood environment. You know, we shot a pilot that was produced in Chicago in December, and we've been shopping it around, playing at a number of festivals. And we had a meeting with the heads of a major network, and I won't say which one. But, you know, they mentioned to us that if they had a great concept that came across their desk today and they wanted to produce it, it would take them 2 years to get that project into a stage and produced. And that's just the nature of big Hollywood and Hollywood labor and Hollywood infrastructure. Whereas an independent producer who gets a great concept, you'll have talent flock to work for it because it's an authentic and real thing, and actors want to act.
Yeah.
And we're trying to exploit that and give them the opportunity to do that and tell great stories.
Ted, your background, I mean, you have a background in finance, you have a background in media, you have a background in creating companies that have helped the ecosystem here in Chicago. How much has that background and that entrepreneurial spirit helped you in finding your way with Chicago Media Angels?
It's an interesting question. A lot of me wishes I went for my passion a lot earlier than I did. But it's funny, I kind of tripped my way into it. You know, I used to work at an investment bank. I left there in 2011 knowing that I wanted to help entrepreneurs build businesses. At the time, I thought that filmmaking would be an expensive hobby I would retire to. The more time I spent trying to invest in tech startups, the more I became convinced that the content was that opportunity. And so for me, it's been, I pinch myself going to work. I think we have a phenomenal opportunity in Chicago. Really, there's four key ingredients to be good at this industry. The first is talent, people. Chicago is just so rich in great, authentic storytellers and talent. So if you look at whether you're talking about colleges and universities, Columbia College, DePaul, the Art Institute, Flashpoint Academy, and then sort of secondary training institutions. So in comedy, Second City, all of the improv theater in town, or you know, theater. Look at Steppenwolf. Look at all of the great actors here. We have people. Two, world-class locations. Obviously, Chicago's a world-class city, but we have a diverse variety of locations, beaches, farms, mountains, forests, you name it. Believe it or not, there are some, I don't know if they're mountains, but they're hills.
They look like mountains on the screen, right?
Yes. So we've got great locations. We now have great infrastructure with stages at CineSpace. And the last piece of that puzzle was competitive finance. And so my background in finance and investment management, some of it, you know, from my seat is sort of simple, but to a filmmaker is not simple. And so a great example of that is the Illinois Film Tax Credit. That's a huge advantage for independent filmmakers in Chicago to get effectively 25 to 30% of their production budget financed. However, I see projects every single day that want to raise their entire production budget on equity and instead of leveraging that tax credit. That's a pretty simple financial transaction that we were lucky at Chicago Media Angels to partner with Signature Bank to be able to provide a very economical solution to filmmakers, and that helps them. I mean, any filmmaker who's got a qualified independent project in Illinois can come to us, and we can give them 25% of their budget. Those are things that are simple to a person with a finance background and very opaque to somebody who comes from filmmaking, and so that's kind of the role I'm thrilled to be able to play. I could not walk into New York or Hollywood or and be a relevant executive producer, but in Chicago, we can bring that experience, and I'm thrilled to have a great team and to be able to provide those solutions to filmmakers right here at home.
Yeah, Ted, I want to continue the conversation because I find it fascinating just the way that we've seen this ecosystem grow and this film industry here in Chicago continue to be ambitious. Ted Riley is an executive director of Chicago Media Angels, an investment group that is not only helping to finance local projects but to focus on organizing investors around Chicago content. Ted, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Justin. Thanks for having me.
727 says, wish this gentleman would run for governor or mayor. I don't think they're talking about me. They're talking about Ted Riley. Wow. Way to go, Ted. It's interesting. I mean, I'm fascinated. I want to get Ted Riley back in studio sometime so we could talk more about the way that you finance and produce an independent film. We've talked a little bit. Mike McNamara has been in talking about films in Chicago, but I love the concept. I've always, and I at some point I'd love to do it. Maybe we could do a radio reading. Schadenfreude wrote two or three screenplays, and we went through the whole process of trying to get independent financing in Chicago. And it was this was 10, 15 years ago, if not 15 now. Amazing process, and one that I had no concept how it worked. And it was interesting to see how, you know, it all played out when it was all said and done. But fascinating to continue that conversation with Ted.
You had the guys on, or the guy that did Box Trolls and Kubo.
Yeah.
Now, clearly he's got money of his own.
That's the,
that he doesn't want to lose, but how did he go about doing
that's
it?
Well, that's Phil Knight's kid.
Correct.
So, I mean, he went out of his way to say that his dad didn't help him with financing, but having your dad run Nike probably helps.
Well, sure,
form,
but,
right?
but you know,
yeah,
still,
but, right.
but people, you know, will look at it reluctantly and look at the films and say, you know, does this thing have legs?
I think it's really interesting to see if the democratization of filmmaking, if you can make films on cameras that don't cost a ton of money, don't have to have film, if the editing is on your computer, which is Final Cut Pro, you know, and you go down the list of ways to make a film and cut those costs, at a certain point, you'll be seeing that number, that million-dollar number, come down and come down. And I think Ted's right in the way that you could do it almost like they do Technori, where people can come out to an event and say, I'll put $100 on this film or I'll put $500 on this film. And it almost becomes a real live Kickstarter for filmmaking. It's a fascinating look at how to undercut a Hollywood industry that is really slow. And he mentioned 2 years for a project, tons of money, labor intensive, can't get around to a lot of competition. If an entrepreneur can come in and swoop in and be able to say, you know, Sony would do that movie for 20, I'll do it for 7. That's the American way. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest tonight is one of the most successful singer-songwriters in Australia, Chicago. It's an honor to welcome Casey Chambers to the air.
If we had a child, people would come from far and near. Even strangers who never knew ya, they'd be singing hallelujah. If we had a boy,
if we had a boy,
we could give him a family name. He'd be sweeter than sugar cane. He'd be braver than Jesse James. We could raise him down where the river meets the sea. I would ride that baby boy while I hold him close till they bury us both and he marries someone like me.
Chambers was just in Chicago playing Thalia Hall. She's touring the States on her brand new record Dragonfly, which was actually a double album. Everything Chambers touches pretty much in her home country of Australia pretty much goes platinum. The country singer is one of the best-selling artists of her generation. She's known to American audiences as well, touring with artists like Lucinda Williams and for some of her music ending up on TV shows like The Sopranos. Casey Chambers has put out 11 LPs in her career, and she's been playing music professionally since the age of 9. And she is in studio tonight. She's brought her guitar. Casey Chambers, welcome to The Download. We appreciate being here.
Oh, thank you so much. I just love it when you guys say The Sopranos, because we would just say The Sopranos. Yeah. It sounds much cooler when you say it than when I do.
It sounds much more Chicago when I say
that's
Sopranos.
True. Yeah, that's true.
Speaking of Chicago, I mean, you've been through here plenty of times in your career. Talk about how special it is to come to Chicago when you tour the States.
I love it. It's amazing. I mean, look, it's kind of even just like the idea of getting to play in Chicago is just cool in itself. Like, not even thinking about the actual gigs when you're here are always amazing, and I've gotten to play in so many incredible venues here in town. But I kind of like just being able to go home and just say, hey, I played in Chicago. That's the best part.
That's the best part.
It's awesome, you know.
It's interesting because, you know, you're on tour right now, and this tour is pretty jam-packed. Just looking at the lineup, I mean, you're every day, and if it's not every day, it's every other day.
Yeah.
Talk about the idea of Is that the only way to really be able to tour the states as an Australian musician, to cram as much as you can into as little a time as possible?
It really is. And you know what? It's a pretty long flight, let's face it. So if you're going to come over here, if you're going to sit on that plane for, I mean, to fly from Sydney straight to LA is like 13 hours in itself.
Right.
And then often we have another flight on it as well. Sometimes we fly straight to Dallas. They fly straight from Sydney to Dallas now. And it's like 16, 17 hours sitting on a plane. So trust me, if you're going to do that, you want to make sure you're packing in as right. many gigs as right. you possibly can. But I do love it over here. I mean, I grew up on all the music that comes from America. So it's, I just love being able to come here and steal you guys' music and then pretend that it's my own and then sell it back to you. You're so nice to buy it still.
That's a business plan. That's a good business plan.
It really, and I mean, when I go back to Australia, I just tell them it's mine. Yeah. I don't tell them I stole it off you guys. I just tell them it's all mine. Yeah, well, I made this up. Yeah.
As I said in the lead, I mean, you've been playing music, you know, since the age of 9. You've been playing in bands. You come from a music family. What does that mean to you when I say come from a music family?
I mean, I guess that's why, part of the reason that music is such a big part of my life and my whole family's life, I had a really kind of unusual upbringing where when I was about 3 weeks old, my dad packed up the whole family and moved us into our car and then took us out to the most remote area in the whole of Australia, like way, way into the middle of the outback in Australia, this place called the Nullarbor Plain. And it really is just like nothing. There's like red dirt, salt bush,
wow.
few wild animals, that's it. And we lived there in our car for the next 10 years of my life while my dad became a professional fox hunter. Yeah, how crazy. I know, it's so weird. Everybody's looking at me like we're the weirdest people in the world. I know, and no, that's how people, even in Australia, when I tell them that story, they look at me like that
wow.
as well. It's pretty strange, but it was just in such a remote area. We didn't, like, we had no TV, no radio, nothing like that. So our only form of entertainment was my dad would bring out the guitar. We'd sit around the campfire and we'd play pretty much mostly American country songs. Like, my dad would play as Hank Williams and Graham and Emmy Lou and Johnny Cash, Mel Haggard, that sort of thing. So that was the only thing that I was really exposed to when I was mm-hmm. a kid, was all of this American music. So in a weird way, I feel really at home being here in America from a music point of view, because that is
the
sound
right,
that I
right.
grew up with and was such a big part of my life. And because I didn't really have any other touch with civilization, I didn't hear any other music except what dad liked.
I think about that isolation, that feel. I would assume being someone who's attracted to music, as it's part of that, something that you really treasure, being in an isolated situation, that you understand it more, you pay attention to it more, you're more disciplined in learning it. Was some of that maybe playing
yeah.
out in the sense that you weren't exposed or in
exactly.
a strange way distracted by other things?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I didn't grow up with, you know, particularly what my kids are growing up with these days. You know, I have 3 kids and their ages range quite a bit. So it's 15, 9 and 5. And there are so many distractions in their lives
yeah, right.
right now.
Yeah, right.
And, I mean, they're living a fairly normal kind of life, I guess, of what normal
yeah, right.
kids do.
Right.
I mean, apart from they travel a bit with me on the road. But, you know, they go to a normal public school and they have their iPods and iPads and, you know, it's just so different. And mine was different again from even the...
Yeah, to your generation, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Even what most kids were growing up with in the 70s.
When was it in that childhood that you recognized that you wanted to do this? This was your passion. This is what you wanted to do.
I started playing music when I was about 9 in a family band, and we started traveling all around Australia and playing in, you know, smoky pubs and
what kind of music?
That
like,
sort
yeah.
of thing. We played some originals, but a lot of it was like Creedence covers and Eagles and, you know, all of the good music that we could get away with covering and keeping an audience happy, you know. So it was kind of like that combination. Then we'd throw in an original every now and then. And then I started discovering music as well on the pop charts. So I started covering like Cyndi Lauper and the Bangles and all of that sort of thing in the band as well. So that was kind of weird. But I was also doing like Emmylou Harris covers at the same time. And then in my sort of mid-teens, my dad took me to see Roseanne Cash in concert. and I had listened to a bit of her music and obviously Johnny Cash and that sort of thing. But there was this lady on the show that I had never heard of before, and she walked out and started singing, and I was just like, my whole life changed from that moment on. And it was Lucinda Williams, who we'd never heard of at the time, and this is, you know, quite a long time ago. And I had just never heard... I'd never heard a voice sound like that. I mean, obviously her voice is just so unique, and that was amazing. But I'd also, I don't think I'd ever really heard a female put her heart on her sleeve in songs like Lucinda did. Most of my biggest influence as a female in music then was Emmylou Harris, and she didn't write a lot of her own songs back then. So I'd never really gotten into the songwriting side of things until I saw Lucinda that night, and my life was just changed forever. Yeah.
Casey Chambers, singer-songwriter, Australian Americana. her new album is called Dragonfly. It's actually a double album. She was just in Chicago playing at Thalia Hall. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. And then you brought your guitar, and Brandon's here. So we'll hear some music from Casey Chambers here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. My guest in studio at the big table tonight, singer-songwriter, Australian-Americana artist, Casey Chambers. She just came through Chicago playing Thalia Hall, and she is in the States promoting her new album, Dragonfly, which is actually a double album. You've had a tremendous amount of success with some of your early music. At the crossover, you mentioned Lucinda Williams and getting a chance to tour with her and Emmylou Harris, but also, you know, being featured on The Sopranos. We mentioned that right at the top. That whole thing kind of made you a star in America in the way that people knew your music and gave you an in. And I was thinking maybe we could hear the song that was played on The Sopranos. So what's the name of the song?
Well, I'd love to play it to you because it really is still my most favorite song to play. I feel like it's just that song that I feel most at home playing that song on stage or in a situation like this, or even just jamming or anything. But, yeah, it's the title track of my first album. It's called The Captain.
The Captain. Brandon Dodd also on guitar.
Searched
That was the song Captain, which amazing to hear it live. Thank you so much for playing it. In studio tonight, Casey Chambers, Brandon Dodd playing on guitar as well. You know, you mentioned that being your first album. To play back, to think about that, to play your first solo record, to play that music, does it change at all having a career after it? I mean, I mentioned 11 albums. Does playing that song bring back the time that you performed it or that you wrote it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do sort of just slip back into, 20 years ago, over that, actually, when I wrote the song. Every night when I play it, I still go back to that same time of when I wrote it, recorded it, and it started becoming such a big song in my life, you know, mm-hmm. not you know, as far as the listener goes, but just for me
you, right,
personally,
right.
I always go back into that place. And it's funny, you know, one of my favourite gigs that I've ever done in my life was right here in Chicago. And it's the first time I ever heard Joe Pug. He opened up the show for me and I had never heard him before. And I remember, like, just being so blown away by his music and loving the gig so much. And then I remember particularly just with the audience in the gig that night, playing the Captain was just one of those nights where planets align. And I think of that every night.
Really?
When I sing the Captain. I think
when
of that
When you play
gig,
the Captain, that's, yeah.
And for some reason, it's just in the bridge. When I get to the bridge every time, for some reason, I just think of that night in Chicago and Joe Pug and just music just being such a big part of my life, yeah. And how important that song is to me and how it has given me a chance to connect to so many strangers all around the world.
Yeah,
it's just such an amazing
Well, I mean, as a singer-songwriter and doing 11 albums and to be performing since you're 9 years old, it makes me think of the evolution of an artist. And you have created such personal music. I mean, if you listen to the lyrics, I mean, you're putting your heart on your sleeve in a lot of these songs. So when you put a set together and you go back to some of the albums where you were in a different place, different time, exploring different emotions than where you are right now with Dragonfly, do you go back? Do you go back to that emotion? Do you go back to that place when you start strumming the guitar and playing that song?
I totally do. And sometimes I don't want to. I've just started playing a song again, which I haven't played a lot in my whole career, from Barricades and Brick Walls, called Million Tears. And I've just started putting that in the set list, and I don't play that song very often. I always just felt like it was just really revealing and exposing sort of song, and it made me feel a bit uncomfortable. And then just recently, I think just maybe turning 40 and going, we don't care about that anymore. Put it out there.
That's
just put
life.
It out there.
That's life,
that
right?
That is life. Exactly. And now I feel a lot more comfortable playing that song, but I still do go back to that place where I feel those same feelings, you know? And it's weird because I don't feel them all the time now. I mean, you know, it's like I guess everyone sort of has these different sides where some days you wake up and you feel like you could take on the whole world and, you know, you feel powerful and strong and all that. And then some days I wake up and I feel not pretty enough. And then that song makes so much sense to me to play that.
Right.
But they're all still in me somewhere. You know, I must be a nightmare to live with. Hence my divorce, probably. Yeah.
That's a different show. A different show.
Yeah.
But I mean, there is something to that. I think of, you know, when you're creating music and music that is so personal, you know, you rarely think about the artists, you know, as you express yourself in that moment of what it means to replay those songs and to go on tour and every night to play the same song over and over, to, you know, have this sort of reflection of who you were at a certain point and where you were.
Yeah, it is. And it's emotionally exhausting sometimes. But it's also, I feel like I am in the perfect job for my personality because I'm a very open person anyway, sometimes a little bit too much, where I don't have a filter and I share a little bit too much on stage. I know that. But I mean, I'm not just like that on stage. I'm kind of like that as a person all the time. if you get stuck in an elevator with me and you're a complete stranger, you're going to know my life story by the end of it. I am sorry
about
that.
Hopefully there's a guitar, right? Hopefully there's a guitar. Australian singer-songwriter Kacey Chambers is in studio tonight. She just released the album Dragonfly, a double album, and she was just in town playing Thalia Hall. Okay, we'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back and we'll hear some more music in studio and continue the conversation with Kacey Chambers. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Australian singer-songwriter Kacey Chambers. She was just in town playing Thalia Hall, and she had just released an album, Dragonfly, double album. You've had such success, you know, to see how the music that you've produced and played in Australia in your home country has just been so wildly accepted. I mean, you've had success in the Billboard charts there. You've been able to really be a voice for a generation there, and it's great. And to be able to come here and tour that music and continue to, what's it mean to you to have the success you've had in your home country and then go out on the road and play every night in a different town, a different place, and like you're back in your 20s?
I seriously still have to pinch myself sometimes to see if it's real, because you know, when I first started playing music, I actually didn't even kind of have I didn't have that driving ambition to be successful in music. I kind of just thought, okay, music is something that I'm always going to do. Mm-hmm. But given the sort of music I play, particularly in Australia, because back then it was not, you know, very common for people to play that music, particularly women in Australia. It was a little bit, I guess, you know, there was a bit more of that kind of edgy alt country kind of thing.
Right.
You know, for guys to play, but there weren't a whole lot of girls playing it back then as well. And I just kind of went, okay, well, that's all right. I just play this style of music and you know, I'm probably going to have a day job my whole life and just play music on the side. So the fact that I haven't had to get that day job yet is crazy. I'm so stoked. It's amazing.
That's great. That's I mean, when you talk about that kind of music. What draws you? I mean, you talked about your upbringing and the ability to listen to Hank Williams and even Lucinda Williams, seeing her live when you were younger. But what keeps you evolving as an alt country or an Americana artist? What is it about staying in that genre and not switching it up and trying something else?
I mean, I listen to a lot of different styles of music, particularly with having three kids that have the age ranges that they do. There's a bit of everything going on in our house. But I always come back to that style of music that I guess is about a feeling and about a story. And it's not always about a story in lyrics, although a lot of, you know, the music that I started out listening to, country music, obviously, mm-hmm. is a lot about stories in lyrics. But even since then, it's kind of, you know, it's widened a lot, you know, yeah. Particularly with Americana music now, where it is just about telling a story within a feeling. And you know, I love connecting with people. You know, I love connecting with people on a really raw kind of level. I don't ever want it to be about, you know, big lighting shows and, you know, fireworks going off on stage. Right. And I find those sort of things quite a distraction.
Sure.
You know, for storytellers.
It'd be a distraction,
you know,
at your kind of show. Would be.
Yeah, I think so.
A light show.
Yeah, wow, right. There's fireworks coming out of her guitar.
Lasers.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, like I said, I like a lot of different styles of music, but for me to communicate best with an audience and people just in general, I like doing it through a real kind of feeling and, you know, that just being based around being real with people. That's what I like. I think Americana music kind of suits that.
You mentioned communication and you can, I mean, even hearing The Captain, I mean, the emotion that comes out of it. You know, you've had, you know, triumph after triumph when it comes to your music. And you've, you know, you sort of faced or at least stared tragedy in the face when you had vocal surgery and what was going to happen with you. And there was a thought that, you know, this is not a place where you necessarily want to have surgery since this is how you communicate.
Yeah.
This is how you evoke the feeling.
Yeah.
So talk about that moment of being in a space where you're going to have surgery on your vocal cords and what you're going to do in that moment.
Well, I honestly didn't allow myself to go to a place where it freaked me out, and I got really scared about it because I don't really have any other skills, so I don't know what I would have ended up doing. So I kind of just had to go, yeah, it's going to be fine. And to be honest, I'd had nodules for 20 years, and I had gotten to a point where I couldn't get through one gig. So I actually, there was no other choice. So
and what would happen? I mean, when you say you couldn't get through a gig, you just go hoarse?
Yeah, I just happened? Like, I mean, I had to kind of, I played for a lot of years where I would end up, depending on where the gig was in the week, you know, if we were at gig number 4, all the keys had to come down of the songs and I'd have to drop a lot of songs as well. There's certain songs that I just couldn't do. And it was frustrating as much as anything because I knew in my head how I wanted to sing and perform and I just couldn't do that. And then I would spend my days not talking. And as you can tell, I like a bit of a chat. So that actually was more frustrating than the gig, not being able to talk. That drove me mad. But it was a lot of stress as well when you're out on tour and constantly just thinking about, am I going to get through this gig? Am I going to get through this gig? And often, you know, I totally believe in what you fear you create, you know, and I'd start making my voice worse because I'd stress so much and all my stress would go to my voice.
I mean, people think about, you know, especially when you see the volume of your tours. I mean, the idea of going play it show to show to show and knowing how you sing and how you perform. I mean, it's a big undertaking. So to have that surgery and to come out of it and for it to be successful, what's it mean to you that you were able to be in that moment where possibly you would have to lose the way you communicate and for you to now have, I don't know, be a situation where you don't take it for granted?
It honestly changed my life. I feel like I, not just musically, but my whole outlook on life in general has changed since that moment, and I feel like a new person. And I really, I wrote this song, which I'll play for you soon if you like, called Ain't No Little Girl, and I wrote it a few years ago before I had surgery. And I never, ever thought of the song. I just went, oh, okay, there's a song, and I put it aside, never played it to anyone, never thought it would end up on a record or anything. And I just didn't even really think of it as a special song. You know, sometimes you just know that something is, it just connects. And usually I do. Usually I think I know when something is really special. But this one, just didn't think any more of it. And then I went through the surgery, went through some hard times in my personal life and started growing into this song. And I really feel like this song was writing me rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
And I started connecting with this song and then went through the surgery. And straight after the surgery, the first gig back that I did after having vocal surgery, I put this song in the set list and it's been in there ever since. And I feel like it is the most important song I've written for myself in my entire life. And when I first wrote it, I was like, oh, whatever, it's just a song. And now I feel like it is part of who I am and it's part of why I am who I am now. And it's sort of, it helped me get to this point. And so the song's, it's pretty special.
Well, let's hear it. Casey Chambers in studio, the Australian singer-songwriter, Brandon Dodd on guitar. Here is the track is Ain't No Little Girl.
It is, yeah.
There we go.
Just like a child, you've made a happy home. Make it look easy to leave me behind. Your cross and a bed, and your cross and a light. You hold out your heart, your and leave it alone. You won't take me down easy, but I ain't made of stone. Well, lesson is learned, and a lesson is lost. Well, I ain't afraid to stand and give a damn and take it like a man. But I ain't no little girl. No, I ain't no little girl. I won't cry, I won't beg, I won't plead, I won't pray, I won't ask you to stay. No, I ain't no little girl. No, I ain't no little girl. I won't break, I won't bend, I won't win, I won't end up with nothing to say.
That's the song Ain't No Little Girl. In studio, Australian singer-songwriter Casey Chambers. She was just in Chicago at Thalia Hall. You're on your way. I mean, you know, you are – the tour is the tour. I mean, you're this is – we've been talking about the tour. I mean, one of the things about it is you are away from your family for a while. I mean, this idea that every night you're doing a show, and it's great to be involved in the passion. But, you know, the idea of – you talked about your three kids. What's it mean – that, you know, you got a break coming up in the tour and you're going to be reunited with your family.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually not usually away from my kids for very long because they come on tour with me a lot in Australia. And in Australia, we tour like, you know, 5 days or something and then back and do another area. But over here, obviously, we've got to come over for a bit longer.
Because of flights, right?
And this is the longest trip that, the longest tour that we have done, well, since before I had kids, actually. Yeah, so we put a little break in the middle.
How does it feel? I mean, for this to be the longest, how does it feel to you? Is it different? Is it strange? Is there any different emotion that comes out of the tour continuing and continuing and continuing?
It's awesome. I love it. I mean, the thing is, you know, it is hard to be away from your family for a certain amount of time. We put a little break in the middle so I could go home and they could I could catch up with them, and then I pick my favorite and bring that one back. depends who's behaved themselves that week, because you know we can only have one flight,
of course.
One extra flight. but it's—I mean, look, honestly, living the dream right now. I feel so lucky. I am over 40. I'm like 41-year-old woman in the music industry who gets to tour all around the world. Plus, I get to have a family and take them with me on a lot of that and share my whole family. That my dad's in my band, my mum sells the merchandise, my brother is my manager. I have my best friends on the road in my band as well, and I'm literally living the dream.
In a strange way, if you think about the story you told about your childhood and living out of a car for 10 years, yeah. Here you are in a bus, you're doing the same thing.
You know what? Circle. The bus is much more comfortable than that Toyota Land Cruiser, let me tell you. Yeah, it's heaps better. Well, and I get a hot shower now. We didn't get any hot showers on the Nullarbor.
Well, we're very lucky that you get to share your passion with us. Casey Chambers is the singer-songwriter from Australia who just came through Chicago. She played Thalia Hall, and she is currently touring the United States on her record Dragonfly, which is actually a double album. Casey Chambers, thanks so much for being my guest on The Download tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Am I not pretty enough? Is my heart too broken? Do I cry too much? Am I too outspoken? Don't I make you laugh? Should I try it harder? Why do you see right through me?
She was great, man. What an amazing performer. Put up a picture on Instagram on the WGN page at WGN Radio. Whew. Great to have her here. The show rolls on. We've had we've already the variety tonight, whether we're talking about Springfield or financial investment in the independent film community or whether we're talking Australian singer-songwriters. We've got more coming up. Broadway director and choreographer, Tony Award winner, six-time Tony Award winner, Casey Nicola. Casey Nicola is the director and choreographer of Something Rotten, the musical that is coming to Broadway in Chicago starting next week. I think previews are beginning, but it's limited run. I think July 11th is the beginning. But, I mean, this guy, it's amazing. You look at his... just his resume. I mean, anyone who has a credit like, I don't know, Book of Mormon, you know, as Spamalot. He's essentially done everything but Hamilton. That's how you look at it. But I don't know a lot about Broadway musicals, not necessarily my area of expertise. But watching a lot of the videos to get ready and watching, you go to YouTube and you put Casey Nicola in, you can do this at home. You see a lot of Broadway playbill, you know, exclusive video of rehearsal with Casey Nicola. And you see them in the, I mean, it couldn't be more Broadway. Left, down, two, and three, and four. And they go at it, and they're just in this room somewhere, that nondescript room, and these actors and these dancers are, and he's like, three, four, stop, bring it back, one, two. That's what he's doing. I mean, he's creating what the entertainment that's on stage for us at a Broadway musical. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible the amount of work that goes into it.
And that's just to get the dance steps down. Imagine transferring that from the small rehearsal room to the huge auditorium stage, to the Oriental Theater, perhaps. I mean, then directing takes on a whole different tone. So, I mean, sought after.
Usually my Broadway viewing is relegated to the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
He's probably done a lot of that.
When they toss the, yeah, this is the Something Rotten currently playing at the Majestic Theater.
And here comes Diary of a Wimpy Kid in front of Macy's. Huh?
All right. Or here in Chicago, you get the, here comes the duct tape patched Garfield. That's my favorite. I got mad the other year. I love that parade, the Thanksgiving parade in Chicago, because they had, I think it was either a Curious George or a Garfield, where they really did. They patched it with duct tape. And then it wasn't there anymore. And I'm like, no. Either you commit to a 10-year run of a duct tape patched float or, you know, floating deal, or you don't. You know what I mean? You can't go 1 year, patch it up, next year get rid of it for the newfangled, whatever's new, whatever's hip.
And God love Matt Lauer. He's really run out of things to say at the end of Macy's. And here comes the big guy himself. Huh?
It's true. I had to ask Casey about
and Savannah
that.
Guthrie. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm freezing.
And all Al Roker can do is think about that big old Italian beef waiting for him at home.
The hoagie. It's an East Coast hoagie. That's right. Yeah. Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, starting on the 11th, the smash Broadway musical Something Rotten will be in a limited engagement at the Oriental Theater downtown. The Tony Award-nominated musical comedy starring big Broadway names like Brian D'Arcy James and Kristen Borrell was directed and choreographed by my next guest, Casey Nicola.
Oh, God, I hate Shakespeare. That's right, I said it.
No.
I do, I hate Shakespeare.
Why?
I just don't get it, how a mediocre actor from a measly little town is suddenly the brightest jewel in England's royal crown. Oh, God, I hate Shakespeare. His plays are wordy, but oh, no, the great Shakespeare. That little turd, he has no sense about the audience. He makes them feel so dumb. The bastard doesn't care that my poor ass is getting numb.
How can you say that? How can you say that?
It's easy, I can say it, because it's absolutely true.
Don't be a penis, the man is a genius.
His genius is he's fooling all of you.
For theater fans, Nicola is a household name. Before the success with Something Rotten, he co-directed the hit Book of Mormon, Trey Parker, and choreographed Monty Python's Spamalot back in 2005. Those are just a couple of the shows that Nicola's worked on. I mean, his resume is outstanding. It really is all of the popular musicals of our time, at one point or another, touched by Casey. And even this week, one of the next productions, Mean Girls, a musical version of Tina Fey's movie, which will be adapted by Fey, is all the talk slated for Broadway 2018. Casey Nicola is a 6-time Tony Award winner. He's currently in London, and he joins me tonight on The Download. Thanks so much for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
All right, so let's talk Something Rotten. What makes Something Rotten work? I mean, as a musical that's really about musicals, or the beginnings of musicals, talk about Something Rotten and what makes a musical like that work.
Well, I think what makes it work to start with is the comedy. Because, your humor is relatable. You know, a lot of people go into it saying, oh, you know, I don't know that much about musicals, or I don't know that much about Shakespeare. But I think that what we sort of did is we took sort of everyday sort of situations that happen now and just put them in that time period. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone can relate to, you know, not getting a break or having a rivalry with someone or that kind of thing. And then, you know, the musical part of it just kept evolving more and more. And it just was a really funny idea that started with, you know, Carrie Kirkpatrick and John O'Farrell and Wayne Kirkpatrick. And once they started talking to me about it, I thought, oh, my God, I'm so on board with that. And then really, you know, we worked so well together, and it was just an absolute blast to work on. You know, and as we were doing sort of pre-production, the musical part of it just kept evolving more. And, you know, we started, you know, making a lot of references to other musicals. And, you know, with the character of Nostradamus, who sees into the future, we were able to have a lot of fun with that and what he was seeing and how they were getting the information wrong.
I mean, obviously, Shakespeare, a huge part of theater history and everything we know about it. But this caricature of him and creating a more sensational celebrity is something new.
Right. Something that people recognize now, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right, exactly. The beauty of it, as you're a director and choreographer, when you talk about choreographing a musical. I mean, it's just amazing to think about all the production. Even today, looking at some YouTube clips and other things about what goes into the rehearsal process to choreograph a musical, not to mention, you know, a smash musical. Talk about all of the work that goes into Broadway musical in 2017.
Honestly, that to me is my favorite part of it, because you get a number that starts as an idea, and then you have to figure out how it's going to dance and how it's going to move, and also if it's a comedy, how you're going to get comedy into the musical number. And it just starts evolving. You know, it's like basically, you know, I'll take the song to start with, and then the dance arranger will sort of join. And then we figure out how the number can be structured, and we figure out, you know, what things we want to hit in it. And then, you know, the dance arranger will write some music, and then I'll just basically lay on a floor and listen to it over and over and over until I start picturing it in my mind as a movie and just seeing it, what it should look like and what it should be like. And then we just start playing, you know, and then we get dancers into a room and I start setting things on them, and then it just keeps evolving.
As a former Broadway actor and dancer, I mean, how important is it for you to have that experience, the experience of being on stage, being a dancer yourself, being an actor yourself, when you get into a room with dancers and start talking choreography?
I think it's pretty great because I sort of know what I like to do as a dancer, and I know where my strengths are, and also I think I can speak the same language as them and know what it's going to take, and also, you know, what might injure them or not injure them, because I was there myself.
Right.
But also, I like telling stories through dance, and I like dancing myself. I don't do it as much anymore. Now I basically, you know, make up the steps and work and play, and then like model it on other people a little bit, and then have my, I basically do it all once and have my associate teach it and do it from then on, you know. But it's really, I love doing it. That's my favorite part of it, is seeing where the numbers are going to go and what they're going to end up being based on some of the music that ends up being composed.
When you made that transition from being an actor and dancer to a choreographer and director, was it difficult to make that transition? You didn't want to jump in and say, move out of the way, let me show you how to do it. Was it difficult for you to be in a different role?
No. You know what's funny is that was the conversation going on in my head while I was doing shows as a dancer, watching things happen. And I was, you know, most of the shows I was involved in were original musicals when I was a performer. And it's how I learned, you know, learned what I liked and what I didn't. And, you know, sometimes I wanted to say, hey, get out of the way. This is how I would do it. But, you know, I was sort of like, I had to quiet that voice in my head and go like, you know what? You can do that yourself. Try to do it yourself and see, stop talking about it and do it. And that's what happened. I ended up, I ended up really going after choreographing on my own.
Directing, when you talk about directing a musical, there are so many facets, there's so many chapters to doing that along the journey. You talked about being in the rehearsal room, but then there's actually teching the space. There's you know, laying it all out, having to be one of the people in the room who has to cut and edit. I think about it, it's such a journey, and there's so many different types of directing. When you started your career and your journey as a director, did you have to get used to that, the challenge of almost using a different part of your brain every step of the way?
No, you know what? I think I've always had that in me, and I think I was always a bossy kid to begin with, so I think that it just happened kind of naturally, you know, and I'm someone that has always liked to take care of people and nurture people, and also, you know, I love the process an actor gets to go through, and I also like, I like creating with people, and I like the back and forth, and I like creating with actors. You know, you have to be so many different things. You're right. You know, you have to be an organizer. You have to be a therapist. You have to be a creator. You have to put on the tech side. You have to be a negotiator. You have to sort of do all those things. But also, you know, there has to be one person that everyone looks to keep everything together and on the same page. You know, there's so many different people and so many different areas I have to deal with and try to, you know, keep the peace and also make sure that everything's running smoothly, you know, and that it's fun.
I would think that I think about the process and everything that goes into it up to even the moment of the first couple weeks of the performance. Talk about your job and your role once it gets to the stage, once you have an opening night and it's time to look at how the audiences are responding to it. Maybe there's critiques coming in from different newspapers and other places, but talk about the role of the director once the product gets up on the stage.
Once it gets on its stage is really when previews start, and that is the most intense time, you know, because you're hearing people respond to it for the first time, and then you're kind of going like, oh man, that's got to change. And I thought that was a sure bet, and there's always surprises that you think were something that was going to be great for sure, and that people are not responding to at all, and then you just have to keep working on it. you know, and usually like in New York, you got 4 weeks before you actually, you know, open the show. So you've kind of got to get everything right then, because there's a time when you just have to stop whether you want to or not.
You a tinkerer? Are you the kind of director who goes in and says every day you're going home with it and you're coming back with something you want to improve?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, like I said, you just kind of have to stop at one point. But then, you know, if the show's a hit, you then get to do a tour of it, like, you know, Something Rotten is able to do. And then you can make changes to that as you continue on, things you kind of wanted to do, you know.
Casey Nicholaw is my guest. He's a Tony Award winner. He's the director and choreographer of Something Rotten, which will be at the Oriental Theater starting on the 11th. You know, when you do get a chance to do a tour and mount it and make that transition from Broadway, from a space in New York to Chicago, is it a chance for you to reimagine some things, some numbers, some the way that the show flows that you couldn't necessarily do in New York?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a few places in the show that we tinkered with, or, you know, you have to change a little bit because the set moves differently, you know, and that's kind of fun to play with and the problem solving of it, you know.
As I mentioned in the lead, I only mentioned two or three shows you've worked on. I mean, you have such an amazing resume when it comes to all these shows. How long do these shows stay with you? Because you're in London right now working on Aladdin, DreamWorks, other shows. You got stuff that's in the pipeline that's going to start coming up here in October with Mean Girls. How long does a show stay with a director?
You mean like in my head?
Yeah, or? I mean, just, yeah. I mean, I don't know how you balance.
It always does. You know what I mean? Because there's always work to do. Like even, you know, coming to see a show in London that, you know, that Aladdin, say, that's been, you know, running here for 2 years. You know, there's always stuff to do to it. And there's also, the fun is you can explore more, learn new things by having a different actor in the role that you created it on. You know what I mean? So you want to adjust things for the people you have if you can. I mean, not majorly, because it takes a lot of craft to get the show to where you want it.
Yeah.
But it's really fun to see what actors, new actors, bring to things.
I mean, you have so many projects that you're working on concurrently. For a kid who loved musical theater, who had all the posters on the wall and wanted to do this for your entire career, to be in a position where you're at now, where you've won awards and you have not only the awards to show for your work, but the work. I mean, you have, you know, seven or eight different things happening in seven or eight different cities. What does that mean to you? Take us back to, you know, your childhood and the idea of wanting to do this job.
Oh, man. You know what? It's a dream come true. It really is. I sort of never forget where I came from. And, you know, I'm here in London right now with three shows running, and I just think back. I mean, I think every day that I'm walking around these streets, you know, for my graduation, we had no money growing up. And my graduation from high school, my dad got me a suitcase and a plane ticket to London. I flew here for 3 weeks. He had a friend that had a friend that had a flat here. And, you know, I'd saved up money from working in a movie theater in San Diego in high school. And, you know, I got to come here and I was just awestruck to get to see. I saw like 17 shows in 3 weeks. Had the time of my life. I was here all by myself. It was really awesome. And I think about that now and being here now and going, wow, if that kid had any idea that I would be here now with three shows running, it's the coolest thing ever. And it's what life's about. You know what I mean? And it really is a dream come true.
Something Rotten's on stage at the Oriental Theater starting on the 11th. Casey Nicholaw is the director and choreographer, the Tony Award winner, multiple Tony Award winner. A pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking some time out to talk with us about the show and your career. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, Mean Girls is going to go to Broadway. Tina Fey is actually writing the adaptation. That'll be great. You know, you think about writers like Tina Fey and New Yorkers, but particularly. I think of her and Alec Baldwin, all the 30 Rock crew. But it's just a matter of time until Tina Fey is writing all the Broadway musicals, right? I just feel like she would have her wit and what we've seen on television, I think, would absolutely transition to the stage. I mean, she came from the stage, Second City.
Yeah,
I just assume that it'll be adaptations then. It's going to be, once she gets a hang of how to write a Broadway musical, it's going to be Tina Fey. She'll be on Broadway till she's 90.
And her, you know, her husband, you know, Jeff Richmond, you know, does music. So
Second City music director, too, when he was here. So there you go. All right, coming up, I was going to say, we have so many great guests coming up. Tonight was no exception. Casey Nicholaw and Casey Chambers coming up later this month on The Download. Get this, dude. Kyle Mooney from Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
He's in a new Brigsby Bear movie, which is getting all the feels on the internet. It's to have him on, and it's so great to see. I love it. I'm one of the guys who loves when a Saturday Night Live cast member has a vehicle in the summer before he comes back or she comes back, right? Mm-hmm. There's something great about Leslie Jones in Ghostbusters 2, along with Kate McKinnon, who's just in Rough Night. You know, but to have Kyle Mooney have his own project, his own, where he's the star, it makes the show so much more balanced or diverse in the way that you have other stars that you've seen them outside of the context of a sketch on a show.
Yeah, I always felt kind of that SNL, especially like in like the Bill Hader years, was always like the individuals were better than the ensemble. Yeah. They would all, you know, Bill Hader was great, Kristen Wiig was, you know, all these people are great, and then they get together, and it was like, sometimes it's okay.
Well, I remember Hader had that with Superbad when he was the cop in Superbad, then he came back and did another season. Kristen Wiig, of course. But yeah, I mean, it's awesome to have. So Kyle Mooney will come in. Jenny Slate.
Another Saturday Night Live veteran.
One of my favorites. She's great in everything she does. Her star turn on the Kroll show.
Oh, yeah.
She played the two PR people. I forgot their names. Someone will tell me, but the great sketch that she did. And, of course, all the stuff she does all over. So she'll be in. She got a new movie coming out. Kumail Nanjiani will be in as well. We'll be talking about Big Sick, which is out now. How great. Another great movie that was given a lot of good reviews. You saw it?
Yeah, I loved it.
So, yeah, I mean, Ray Romano does a pretty good job playing the dad in that movie.
When we finished the movie, I said, you know, like, I was my next for when we do like Never Have I Ever was going to be like Never Have I Ever realized what a national treasure Ray Romano is, because he's great in every. I sort of watched Everybody Loves Raymond. You know, he's
right.
Fine,
right.
But then, you know, when he's been on Parenthood and he was on that TNT or that TBS show like The Men of a Certain Age,
yeah. and then he was the sidekick on Vinyl. Like he was like and
Vinyl, he was great.
The 70s record executive.
And he's just like so good in The Big Sick. Yeah,
he is. So Kumail will be on. Marcus Sakey will be here. Dean Richards. You're going to have Dean Richards at the big table. I've been working this one. I feel like the guy from River Monsters trying to catch the big fish. Like every time I saw him at the Pride Parade, I'm like, Dean, come on.
Wore him
please, down. Please. He's like, all right, let's check.
He couldn't say no in front of Bozo when you asked him in front of Bozo.
Did ask him right in front of Bozo. That might have been the reason. We'll do more on the Download in Chicago Business. Mark Lawrence from Spot Hero. Julie Szymanski from Lifeway. Katrina Markoff from Vosges Chocolate.
Oh, yeah.
We'll do more with music. The Feelies. It'll be fun, right? They're coming to Pitchfork.
Mm-hmm.
The old 80s college rock band. They're kind of predates the alternative rock explosion.
Yeah.
And Jim DeRogatis, one of Jim DeRogatis' favorite bands. And really, he points out this band paved the way for the music to be played everywhere. And yet, bands like the Feelies, they never get due credit.
Right, I know. Because like when we were trying to get them, the guy was their PR person was like, well, they have day jobs. I'm like, Feelies have day jobs. This is not right. They should be millionaires, you know, right. In the lap of luxury.
Oh, man. I know. That breaks your heart when you hear that kind of stuff, although they probably like it, you know.
I'm sure, you know, I don't even know what they are. I mean, it could be related to music. They run studios or what, you know, who knows what it is. But
their day job is making music.
Yeah, that's
their day job is doing the new Feelies record, yeah. Just the way the guy says it. Yeah, well, they have day jobs.
That could be, yeah.
That could be it. So, yeah, we got a lot of great guests coming up. I'm very excited about this. David Lowery is the director of A Ghost Story.
That's the one with
Casey Affleck.
Casey Affleck, where he's the ghost, where he's the sheets over his body the whole time.
A lot
is that
great...
a spoiler alert? That's in the trailer.
It's in the trailer. If it's in the trailer, it's okay. There's a lot of great indie movies that are coming up. You know,
I know this is kind of my jam.
This
or
is
I heard
your
somebody.
Time?
I heard somebody today say, you know, this is my jam and my jelly. Somebody say that today.
Nice little double.
Yeah. I wanted to...
This is my
like,
jam.
Yeah, because like these are like when we went to go see The Big Sick. Yeah, we saw the Brigsby Bear trailer. We saw the Ghost Story. We saw I mean, these. This is my Wonder Woman Transformers.
I love how, and it's probably not new, and I'm sure we could have somebody on, you know, Elliot would be good, or someone to come on and talk about the indie comedy or just indie movie craze of the summers. Like, I always thought summers were for blockbusters. And I don't know when it kind of switched around where you're getting more and more indie films that come out. Good stuff, great stuff that's coming out and really playing to mainstream audiences in the summertime, July, August. I always mm-hmm. thought that was like February type movie.
Yeah, or, you know, like the fall. Like,
yeah,
you know,
October.
For your Oscar consideration.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but I mean, I thought the summer was for superheroes and cartoons.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, last year we had, was it, when did we have it on? We did the Jeff Bridges movie was in the summertime.
Oh yeah, the one that the
yeah, the country, the western.
Yeah,
yeah. I forgot the name of it, but it was great.
Yeah,
with Chris Pine.
I
know, right? You know, I don't remember. I have to be honest, like, this job is eating away at my brain. There's only so much that you can put in there to get ready. And I feel like there are many times, Pete, where I will have a moment where I'm like, I spent a day with you. I spent a day with this film, a day with this musician, a day with this television show, a day with this author. And then the next day, if you say, hey, how was that author with that book? I'm like, what book?
Yeah, on to the
next. I moved to the next. Like, and I feel like that happened. There are so many times where I'll be looking at an author or a book in the store, or maybe a movie, the trailer on Comcast. I'm like, oh yeah, I saw that.
Hell or High Water was
Hell or High Water. Yeah. That's a great movie.
Yeah, it was good.
It happens all the time. I'll be in the bookstore. I'm like, oh yeah. Or like a poster, like for what's coming up, an empty bottle or something. I'm like, oh yeah, I know those guys. I know that. Yeah, if you just came up to me and said, oh, yeah, do you know this band? I'd be like, what? No. It's Download here on 720 WGN. Coming up, Justify Your Love for the Best Worst Movies of All Time. The neo-futurist, Rachel Klaff. Stephanie Shaw will be in studio, too. Excited to have them both here. We'll talk about this week's worst movie that they're doing the stage reading of up at the neo-futurarium. But also, we'll take your calls and suggestions for the worst to add to the pool. Because we've had such success in the last 3 weeks. And I feel like what's happening here is the beginnings of what could be the Download's first film festival. Right? Pete, you like that idea? I think that this could be it. The worst, best where it wouldn't be the first concert. I mean, people do that kind of stuff. Nick DiGiulio mm-hmm. does great film festival type stuff. But the movies, I want at least a screening. Maybe we don't make it a festival. We make it a contest where one lucky viewer gets to watch with me and you at 3 o'clock in the afternoon before the show in our office on a phone right off of YouTube. What do you think of that? So the first week, we've been doing this for a couple weeks now, 3 weeks. The first week, it was a film called Bad Ronald. It's a film from the early 80s. And get this, it's about a thriller, horror almost. It's about a kid who lives in the walls of a house. They built around him for some reason. And his parents, they die, and they forget about him. And a new family comes into the house. And now Bad Ronald just peeks on the new family. It's a thriller. Bad Ronald. That's number one. Number two, and I'm only getting this, I've done no more research than what we've done just from being a part of these segments. Number two was a late 70s movie, comedy, starring Billy Crystal. The movie was called Rabbit Test, and it is a movie in which Billy Crystal gets pregnant. It's supposed to be a comedy. It's got a lot of the stars from Match Game are in it. But according to David Kadesky and the others who talked about this movie, the people who called up and text said this was not funny. And I was talking to my friend Neil, who's in town. He's a big movie guy. He used to work for Troma and also Facets at here in Chicago. And he said that he has Bad Ronald on DVD. And he said he has made it his life's work to find a copy of Rabbit Test, and he can't find it.
Really?
Yeah, he said it's a very difficult movie to find, but the idea, Billy Crystal.
Is Billy Crystal in charge of this?
He's pregnant. I'm sure.
But he's using his, wielding his Hollywood power to keep it suppressed.
He's going to all the different second-run DVD shops and be like, or VHS stops. Get it off the shelf.
I want to see the people from Match Game.
I want to see this movie so bad. Pregnant Billy Crystal. The third movie, which seems to be more... this was a unanimous. I mean, this was everybody in the room said the movie Tiptoes, starring Gary Oldman. There was another star to it that was a big deal. Was the worst movie of all time. And the trailer, it's hilarious. And it has something to do with Gary Oldman playing a little person in a movie about little people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a conquest medieval knight kind of movie, or, you know, kind of Game of... I feel like it to be sort of Game of Thrones-ish, but it's not. I think it's just a psychological, like, relationship movie. But it sounds awful. And if you watch the trailer, even now, go into YouTube and look up Tiptoes, it's supposed to be the worst trailer of all time. Best worst. So those are the three movies that have won so far.
Rent out the music box for an afternoon.
Oh, man.
Just run these things ragged.
We should see if, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like it should be more, like, exclusive, our film festival. Like, music box would be great. But I feel like it should be, like, some, like, I'm sure Ro's got a screening room in his house. Like, Ro Khan's house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we go to some...
Special
person who's got reclining seats.
Mm-hmm.
Five or six deep. I had this great, my wife's friend, she lived in the condos, with new condos downtown, one of the huge building. Don't get me started on this, because I don't know the name of the building, but it's over here in River North. But not only did it have a pool in the back, which I was like, this is awesome. And if you go out there on a Saturday afternoon, they don't even let the residents bring guests because it's such a Vegas weird pool scene with loud music and booze and everybody shoulder to shoulder in bikinis. This is downtown Chicago, by the way. And secondly, and it's equipped like a, like, and it's not, come on. You know, my first apartment was in Roscoe and Damon. And the door kept coming off the hinges. These are equipped with a gym in the basement, a study room. But they also had a screening room you could go watch with like 12.
Like you could rent it out for a night or whatever.
And I don't even think it's rent. I think it's just you live there. Show your membership card. It's one of these towers over here. But my point being, that would be the kind of place we do. Because not only could we watch the movie there, we could then do some cycling in the gym, and then there's a basketball court, and then just go outside and listen to, Sugarland or whatever the band is that would be playing. Not Sugar. What's it? Every morning gonna
hail. Sugar Ray.
Sugar Ray.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
While we drink our tequila sunrises out by the communal pool.
That is a day. That is a day.
See, that's the kind of festival I'm looking for.
Yeah, I'm
right?
in. Yeah.
You're in? Okay, good.
Yeah, let's do this.
Then it's like a VIP. You know, you get to come with Kaufman and Zimmerman and probably some lawyers who need to make sure, you know, with the tequila sunrises.
Up and up, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for sure. That we definitely have to have some sort of event to show these shows. Maybe we can work with the Neo Futurists to do, with Rachel and company, to do a stage reading of these. Maybe this is the new season for next year. But that's coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. So you suggest this week's worst, best, worst. And we'll give you a prize. We got pizza to give away tonight. 312-981-7200.
How great is that?
I know, right? You just say, you know what's the funniest or the best, worst movie of all time? This movie. And then you get a pizza. Sometimes we make life too hard. You know, like maybe it's too simple. My friend Neil, I told him we were doing this tonight, and he goes, Viva Knievel.
Viva Knievel.
Viva Knievel. That's the movie that he would choose. He didn't give me much more information. I'm going to ask Rachel about it. Viva Knievel.
Does it have anything to do with Evil Knievel? The famed
I think.
Motorcycle jumper?
Maybe it's like he's in Vegas or something
like that. Snake River Canyon?
I don't know. We'll see. There's great stuff that's coming in tonight. So this is going to be a blast. We're going to have a lot of fun. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. I haven't had a chance really to talk about two things of importance. One, Springfield, the budget. Two, the Cubs. I mean, you can't get shellac like that at home. They're 4.5 back.
It's ugly. Ugh.
Don't worry, folks. Teddy Roosevelt's coming back for two shows at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. Sponsored by American Sale, of course, with John Williams on Saturday, August 12th at the MAC at the College of DuPage. TR made famous the African proverb, speak softly and carry a big stick. So this is our big shtick. 26th President of the United States in an unrehearsed conversation live on stage. And TR will answer questions from the audience as well. We'll talk about Roosevelt's life, adventures, and feather-ruffling past, plus his views on our current feather-ruffling days. Tickets to Big Shtick Teddy Roosevelt with John Williams, sponsored by American Sale, are on sale now. You can buy tickets online or by phone for the 10 o'clock and 1 p.m., 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. shows. Buy online at WGNradio.com/events or call the Mac box office, 630-942-4000. Tuesdays through Saturday, noon to 6. These shows sell out, so don't wait to get your tickets. Get all the details at WGNradio.com/events. Our Big Shtick is sponsored by American Sale for all your patio, pool, spa needs, and more. Visit one of their 9 Chicagoland locations or AmericanSale.com. I want to go see that. That'll be fun. August 12th. Saturday, August 12th. Oh, darn it! I can't go. That just really that was a genuine bum out. You just heard me get bummed out because my schedule popped into my head saying, that's the day that you are going up to Shotgun Eddie's in the Wolf River.
So you won't be around for that.
No. I'm going that weekend to go whitewater rafting with my son, yeah.
That sounds like a blast.
That's great. I mean, I thank all the Download Nation for reminding me because we had talked about it not too long ago.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, I forgot about that. And I was like, I did that when I did it like 12 times when I was a kid. We said it's a 5-hour trip or whatever up from Wonder Lake. And you go up there and it's like they have two treks. One, which is like the 2 or 3 hour day that only does a couple of the rapids. And then there's like the 6-hour trip that goes over the waterfall at the end. We're doing the shorter one. But you really, truly go over waterfall.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerously fun.
Oh.
I don't know. It feels fun. Yeah. I haven't done it in a long time. So
you don't like Great America, and you don't like roller coasters. I feel this is kind of similar. I mean, it's similar to the log ride, perhaps. But you know, you don't. I'm not. I don't look at you as an adventure person.
Well, thank you, number one. I think that the man-made roller coasters and whatever, like the idea of 30 seconds of going as high as you can and as upside down as you can and whipping around as fast as you can. I don't know. I think a lot of people share this. It just makes you nauseous. When you get done, you're like, now I'm nauseous and my shoulder hurts. Thanks, Whizzer. You know what I mean? Like, who needs that? So this is different. This is different in the sense that it's nature and it's usually not that dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, we're not doing the Yellowstone. You're not going down the Colorado River.
Okay.
You know, this is mid-state Wisconsin.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's great. And you go to Shotgun Eddie's, which is the place that you get the raft from. And you know what? I got to trust Shotgun. I don't know if it's Shotgun or Eddie. I don't know what he goes by. Eddie might be his last name.
Oh, know? Really?
Yeah. Maybe he's like Ralph Eddie, Ralph Shotgun Eddie. I don't know. I never really paid much attention to it. So a budget. We didn't talk much about it. Patty's going to have it all at 11 o'clock, talk about being down there for it. You know, a really crazy day. And I didn't even get a chance to talk to Patty when she was on, which I'm glad we didn't. But the idea that somebody went into the governor's office and put some white powder up in the air and that had to shut things down for 2 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. That sounds like what Seth Rogen would do in Neighbors 2. You know, to shut down the sorority. You know, if you find out it was, like, politically motivated in some way to, like, stop a vote or stop something from happening. Yeah, it really does. It feels like, oh man, we need a Neighbors 2 this. Somebody's sitting at home going, they're sitting in their office. What do we do? I've got an idea. Let's get some of that foot powder. We'll shut it down. It's kind of annoying, you know? So now we have a budget, and as, you know, we talked about in this program, there has been a lot made about the governor's push to tie together turnaround agenda items, ideology, essentially, workers' compensation, term limits, pension reform, even negotiations with the union to the budget. Because the governor's point was, otherwise these will never get brought up. They'll never get through the House and Senate. The only way any of these reforms are going to happen to make Illinois a more friendly state to business is if we tie this all together so that Democrats will understand that it's imperative that it gets done. And if it doesn't get done, we'll have a government shutdown. Well, the only problem is the state didn't have a government shutdown. They had judges that put court orders in to keep people getting paid. So we never had what happened in New Jersey or Maine in the last week, where they had a government shutdown for 2 or 3 days and the pressure mounted and they fixed it. Here it went 2 years because we didn't have that. That would be the first thing I would do coming out of this. The next time the lawmakers get together, which will probably be, I don't know, November, the way they work, that would be the first thing on the list. No more can a judge halt. Like, we go back to government shutdown. I think that every lawmaker should understand that. And if any of the leaders, including Speaker Madigan, got in the way of that, I think that there needs to be some sort of accountability. Because we saw when you don't have government shutdown in your constitution or in your bylaws or whatever it might be, that it can be manipulated. And it just got manipulated to the tune of $15 billion in unpaid bills. And there you go. So, you know, as much as it's great that the lawmakers today got a budget, which is just a piece of paper that says this is what we intend to spend, it doesn't really mean anything. But just the idea they did that, that's great, wonderful. But there's a long way to go. And I think what people miss, and what I can understand from covering this stuff for the last 3 years, is that the damage can and probably will be permanent. Meaning, just because they have a budget doesn't mean that every social service agency and everybody who has schools and other things in the area, that all that is magically fixed. What it means is that we can now start to look at the damage that was caused by this 2 years off. And that's where it's going to get very difficult for us as a society, because then you're going to go in 2 years, why is this so expensive? I mean, and in a way, I mean, that, I guess, was the plan of the governor all along, right? Was to say, right now in 2015, 2014, now's enough is enough. We can't continue to do this because in 5, 10 years, the future is going to be unbearable. So we need to shut this down now. And I would maybe argue that he could have had a better chance to get some of those turnaround agenda items through if we did have a government shutdown. If, you know, we went 3 or 4 days and parks were closed and people weren't getting paid, the Democrats might say, okay, you know what? All right, let's put some of this in here. This is, you know, maybe as opposed to the way it played out. And now, and I find as a pretty, I would say, a voter who pays attention and votes in all the elections, and I pay attention to stuff, I find it very disingenuous already that Governor Rauner is, his reelection campaign is, I didn't raise taxes. I just find it disingenuous. I'm not saying I vote for him or whoever the Democrat's going to be. It's not a party line thing. But you were just a week ago saying you were that would be fine if you tied it to something else. It didn't get tied to something else, but that you can't change your tune now just because you didn't get what you want. I'm not going to buy that when I hear the speeches coming up in debates and what have you in the primaries or even in the general, where they're like, they all raise taxes, not me. Come on. It's hogwash. You were going to do it anyway. You said you were going to do it yourself. But it will be interesting to see if, and what I find to be the thing to pay attention to, is, was the governor right? meaning if a budget got done and the ideological things, the fights over education, which will be next, education funding, workers' compensation reform, pension reform, term limits, if those continue to get pushed away, if Madigan does exactly what the governor said he was going to do, if he continues to push them and they never talk about it and it never gets out of committee and blah, 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 all the way down the line, then the governor was right. You have to tie some of those ideological reforms to the budget to get everyone's attention. Otherwise, the speaker and the Senate president are going to push it away because they'll find ways to never get it to the floor. And maybe that's a problem. But, I mean, this last time I checked, and this is the downside to, I guess, democracy. Look for there should be a new segment called Downside, the Downside of Democracy, is that when you have a two-party system and one party controls majority in both houses, they get to set and dictate the terms in which they're doing things. Now, you can argue as, day, as long as the day is that we're in this predicament because of that majority rule, Democrat majority rule in the state of Illinois. But that doesn't mean that Governor Rauner can come in and say, you have to change that, the way that you do things, even though they have the majority. It proved it right here. They will say they tried to work with the governor all the way through for the last 2 years. But the truth of the matter is, I mean, they were one vote, two vote, one arm, two arm away from doing this exact same thing in 2015. So what have we gained as taxpayers and citizens of the state of Illinois from essentially a who's got the bigger chest game that just went on? I'm looking forward to listening to Patty. She'll have a nuanced approach to this, and she will have a lot of information that a lot of other places won't, coming up at 11 o'clock tonight. And we will definitely be looking forward to that. All right, coming up, we shift back to entertainment tonight. The best, worst movies of all time. Texts are already coming in. I'm very excited. There's some really good ones. For you to justify my love, pray for you to justify my love. Oh, and this song. I don't know if I like this song, man. It just brings back weird, unconfronted memories of childhood, of adolescence. But it's our theme song. Tonight we continue our Thursday night segment in honor of the best pastime in film, identifying the bad ones. That's right. We all love the bad movies, not the ones that set out to be bad, like parody movies and the like. No, we love the ones that are made in earnest, setting out to be the best film in the history of cinema. And instead, well, we get Bad Ronald. The segment is in conjunction with the series that came from the Neo Futurarium, the long-running summer series that presents stage readings, the best, worst movies of all time. It's running through July 15th, 7:30. We call this segment Justify Your Love. You call up, text your favorite bad movie, justify why it's so bad. And the best bad movie choice will get you a prize, a pizza tonight, 312-981-7200. Let's have some fun. In studio tonight, creator Rachel Claff, as always. Good to see you, Rachel. How are you?
You too. Very good.
How was Face Off? That's the first. The only question I have tonight planned is, how was Face Off?
It was tremendous. We had a great crowd, and everyone was doing just their 100% best. It was astonishingly good.
Okay, so coming up here,
yes,
this week, you are going into the genre of horror.
Yes.
Suspiria.
Suspiria.
What is Suspiria? I've never heard of it.
Suspiria is a 1977 horror movie. Some say it's a classic. And we've had a lot of controversy surrounding this because people really feel that this is an excellent movie. I disagree respectfully, but it is an Italian horror movie made by Dario Argento. He's a pretty famous classic horror filmmaker. The plot in a nutshell is that a young ballet dancer goes to a prestigious academy in Germany to study dance and rapidly realizes that there's something really evil going on at the academy. Will give it this. It is gorgeously shot. He really knows his stuff. It's beautiful to look at. But, oh, my God, the script.
Controversy.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know what? We've got a ringer tonight. Joining us on the line, Stacey Ponder. Stacey used to do the blog, The Final Girl, about horror movies. She's also a commissioned artist. She does the commissioned art based on horror films. And she's also a filmmaker in her own right. Stacey, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
I'm
so,
ready to rumble.
All right, Stacey. So why don't we start off right away with Suspiria. Do you believe that this belongs in the stage readings of the best worst movies of all time?
You know, I am a huge Suspiria fan. Here's the thing. Suspiria, I finally figured it out today, is that Suspiria is like Schrodinger's horror movie. You know what I mean? It is absolutely a stone-cold classic of the genre.
Okay.
And it is also a bad movie. And I can see whereas, especially with a staged reading where you've just got the script.
Yep.
Yeah, it absolutely belongs there. But you'll never hear me say that in public. So.
Right. Just on the radio in front of a bunch of people.
So, you know, would never admit it out loud. But yeah, it belongs there, absolutely.
Stacey, I mean, let's talk about the idea of horror and where horror films fit in with the best, worst movies of all time. Because we have texts coming in already, that really, it seems like that genre, more than any of them, seem to grab people's attention for the worst movies of all time.
I can see that. Some of my favorite bad movies absolutely are horror films. I think one of the great things about the genre is that basically if you've got a camera, you can make a horror movie. And so you get a lot of more amateur productions, I would say, because there's a lot of backyard horror movies. And now with the internet, YouTube, Netflix, all of that, these movies are sort of just assimilated into the horror category.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. Didn't they already, they made a documentary about it, yeah?
Oh, yeah. I think so. I mean, it's one of the greatest things about the genre is that even so many, you know, current professional horror filmmakers were fans. You know, you talk to any young director and they're going to be like, oh, yeah, Argento is the best. Oh, I love John Carpenter.
Right.
And, you know, so what came before influences what's out there now. Right. So it's a genre of the people.
And much like a photocopy, if you keep making copies of other people, you're going to end up with something really incomprehensible.
All right. That's a good point. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're justifying our love for the best worst movies of all time. 608 says, did I miss Beastmaster? Did Beastmaster make the cut?
We haven't talked about Beastmaster, but that definitely qualifies.
I don't even know what Beastmaster is.
How many sequels to Beastmaster are there? Stacey, do you know?
Oh, God, there's at least, I think it goes up to at least three or four.
Yeah, I think you're right. Sure. Definitely three.
Yeah.
What, I mean, yeah. Dar, Beastmaster.
Right? That was his name?
Dar?
Dar. I think that was his name. And he could communicate with the beasts because he had the crystal thing. Mm-hmm. And, the witches wanted it. Oh, man, I was into that movie when I was a kid. Don't tell me it's a bad movie. I had impeccable taste.
I have a bunch of movies tonight already. It's amazing. Okay, so
I know, people
really stepped up to the plate.
They,
how about Killer Clowns from Outer Space? And we kind of did these before.
That I would say might be dancing with parody of bad movie. Because we've talked about this, that we like to, at least at our festival, when the stage readings that we do, we like to pick movies that took themselves dead seriously at the time, for whatever reason. The more someone thought this was a good idea, the more ripe it is for exploiting it on stage.
And now, Stacey, I want to bring up a sore subject because Rachel said it was sore. Bad Ronald, you
don't say it.
You believe Bad Ronald, which was the first best worst, that was the one that won week one. You don't know that should fit in this category.
Well, again, it's interesting to look at these movies through the eyes of someone who is not necessarily a genre fan.
Yeah.
Because on paper, yes, Bad Ronald is crazy. It just, you know, and I mean, the script isn't great. But horror fans love that movie, and rightfully so, because it's creepy and it's nuts.
Yeah.
And the idea of someone living in your walls is completely terrifying.
It is. I think you have a really good point, because like there are a lot of horror movies that I've seen that are bonkers off the rails, but there's at least one shot that merits like a good, deep, to the marrow scare. Like Sleepaway Camp. The end of Sleepaway Camp is terrifying, no matter how you slice it.
No pun intended.
Oh, sure. Oh, you know, there's a movie called, it might be good for you. I don't know. I haven't seen it in years. It's called Track of the Moon Beast.
Okay.
It's about a man who, a meteor comes down and a piece of it breaks off and hits him in the head. And as you would expect, that causes him to occasionally turn into a lizard monster.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
Sure.
Right. Okay. Terrible movie. But there's a scene where he's killing someone out, a husband outside, and the wife is inside, and she's all scared, and the blood is coming under the door. And that scene, it works.
Yeah, exactly.
In this awful, awful movie.
Yep.
All right. Yeah. 773 asks, wasn't Bad Ronald remade 2 years ago called The Boy? Like, oh. That they might have already gone back to the idea of the kid stuck
living
in the walls.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah. All right, 312.
Yeah, it's not a remake, but it's definitely The Boy's got. I love The Boy too. If you want to talk, I'll throw down about The Boy too. You say it's bad. Oh my god.
We're gonna find something that you think is bad, Stacey, by the end of the night. That's my goal, is to find something. Just that you find that's irredeemable.
So low
that you'll never find it.
Well, Stacey Potter's on the line. Rachel Klaff's in studio. She's a creator of It Came from the Neo Futurarium, which is on stage. The best stage readings of the best worst movies of all time. The next one will be coming up here Saturday night at the Neo Futurarium up in Andersonville at Foster and Ashland. All right, we'll take a break. 312-981-7200. We're going to start reading off all of the movies that are coming in tonight. You can text, you can call. The winner tonight get some pizza. Stay with us. We're justifying our love for the best worst movies of all time. In studio, Rachel Klaff. She's the creator of It Came from the Neo Futurarium, the stage reading series, one of the best in Chicago every summer. The best worst movies of all time are on stage at Neo Futurarium every Saturday at 7:30 through next Saturday the 15th is the final one, which is crazy.
I know it was we had a short run this summer. We usually do 6 weeks
until November.
I know.
There's so many good stuff. All right, we've got a lot going on. Stacey Ponder is on the line. Stacey, we're going to call you our horror film expert. We have a lot of horror films coming in. Also joining us in studio, the director of this week's stage reading, Suspiria, Stephanie Shaw. Stephanie, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, you're here?
Yeah.
Suspiria, before we move on, Stephanie, what makes Suspiria a great film to put on stage at the Neo Futurarium?
Okay, it's a terrible film to put on stage. Which is probably why I wanted to do it. I wanted to see what would happen if you stripped the beauty from this film, because it is a great example of form over function.
Okay, good.
You know, so if you take all the beautiful style and the gorgeous pictures away, what is left is a festering pile of meat that was somehow
that someone
ordered
is stabbing a knife
from
into
a
repeatedly.
Reputable firm, but has kept in the attic, which actually happens in
oh,
the
it
show,
does. Yep.
In the movie.
Wow.
And then they're surprised because maggots appear. None of us are surprised about the maggots. Well, we are at first, but then they spend a long time explaining how the maggots happen.
Supernatural maggots.
It's a very strange film.
All right, good. Hey, that's a selling point. Did Stephanie nail it? Stacey, what do you think?
Well, I mean, absolutely. But here's the thing is that I feel like you could say this about almost any horror film, really.
No, that's true.
If you stripped away all the visuals, because horror films, so many of them are about the atmosphere and the visuals, and they don't even need dialogue to sort of set a mood to evoke something in a viewer. And so if you take all of that away, even, you know, Halloween, something like the classics, it's just dopey teenagers talking to each other.
Yeah.
Right.
You know?
All right. So I've got some great stuff coming in, some great movies, horror and otherwise. So we're going to get to them now. 312-981-7200. Let's start off tonight with Harold. Harold, you're on the line. Harold, what's the best worst movie? Justify your love.
It is 1977, The Incredible Melting Man.
The Incredible Melting Man. What is it? What is the plot of this, other than there's a man who melts?
Well, he's a mascot, and his this spaceship gets a little too close to the sun.
Like it does, yeah.
Mission Control manages to get him back on track and get him back to the Earth. They put him in a hospital because he has these severe burns. And he is, I guess, due to his visit to the sun or near it, he begins melting and killing people.
Melting and killing people.
Right. Yes, and Alex Reber stars as Steve West, and it has in parentheses the Incredible Melting Man. So they put it in the description of his character.
And exposure to the sun compels one to kill people.
It does in this. There's
a lot of radiation up there.
Sure, Harold, this is the lead.
I'll buy it.
We'll put you on the leaderboard, Harold. Thank you. Thank you
for that. I'll tell you something. At the end, he just melts away, and the garbage man finds a pile of clothes with all this goo on it. And in the garbage
truck. Come on, man.
That's an ignoble end.
That's good. I love it. All right. Thanks, bud.
All righty.
That's the worst ending since Jack Nicholson froze to death in The Shining. I'll say it.
You'll say it. Throw it down.
She'll go there.
All right. Let's keep going here. I'm going to go through some of these. 319 says the movie Joyride, which I'm not familiar with. Joyride.
Are you familiar with Joyride?
I don't know.
You're sighing.
I don't know if it's new or old. I may be thinking of something else.
We need more information.
Yeah, we need more information.
Another for Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Yeah.
Okay. 414 says, how about the movie Rubber? R-U-B-B-E-R, Rubber.
Does anyone know this film? I feel like I've heard of it.
How about a killer tire?
Yes, you're right.
Killer car tire.
Yes, a killer car
tire.
Which
is that sort of, deliberate camp versus unintentional camp.
Yeah.
Is the whole key, I think. Mm,
okay. And you think this one's deliberate?
Yeah, I think. I mean, anyone who's going to be like, hey, I'm going to make a movie, it's going to be about a killer car tire, has to know.
Yeah. They've run out of options.
I don't think they made that with a straight face.
Yeah, right.
Well, what happens when you do your killer car movies, you do your Christine's, your Maximum Overdrives, and then you just got to strip it down to the tires.
Yeah.
It's low budget. It's
bigger,
what's left over.
Or go bigger.
Or go bigger of like a kill dozer.
Yeah.
You just go bigger.
Yeah.
Go bigger. Okay. Yeah. Let's go to Scott. Scott, what do you got for Justify Your Love for what movie?
It was called Shockwaves, and I'm going to say mid-70s, 76, 77, and it was about a mad scientist who kept a group of SS Nazis in a pond in his backyard underwater and would break them out to do the dirty work every once in a while. It was the worst. I mean, it was unbelievably bad.
Don't you love the 70s?
Oh, my God. Anything went.
Yeah.
And it did.
Yeah, very bad.
All horrible. Right. Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it. Thank you, man.
I love it.
Some good stuff tonight. Here is a movie. I wish that I spent more time enjoying the finer things in life, bad movies.
Yeah.
Like, I just missed all these movies. But 847 says, is P2 on the list? What is P2?
I am looking at the synopsis of this, and it sounds bonkers and boring at the same time, which is an unusual combination. It's about a girl who goes down to her parking garage to the parking garage on Christmas Eve, and the security guard knocks her out. And now Angela must fight for her life in order to escape from the garage.
Oh, P2, like parking structure.
I think so.
Okay, I got it.
What's it got to do with Christmas?
I don't know. It's a red herring. But if it's like the parking garage I tried to get out of today, that movie's going to be 4 hours long. Holy moly.
All right, let's keep going. All right, we'll keep going here. 708 says the worst horror movie, Candyman.
Oh, I kind of liked Candyman.
I knew Stacy would not allow this.
Stacy's mad. Yeah. Okay, Stacy, defend.
I will not stand for a bad word against Candyman. It's so good.
It is kind of great.
Oh, my. And as a Chicagoan, I assume, how can you not love Candyman, which takes place in Cabrini Green?
It does. Yep.
Yeah.
Right?
And I would like to say bees.
Yeah, bees.
There's a lot of bees. How can you not like that?
Yeah. They make everything better. They're the best part of Wicker Man.
Oh, yeah. Yes, they are. They try to save us.
Right?
Oh, they do.
There's a lot. There are a lot of movies coming in right now,
Nicolas Cage.
We have hit a nerve here in the Midwest because I just got a flood of about 25 different texts.
Oh,
on
boy!
Movies, so here they come. We're gonna have
rapid fire.
Do we have a break before the news, or do I just stay? Okay. All right. Let's keep going. All right. 847 says Light of Day, Joan Jett and Michael J. Fox.
I wonder if this is a... Do you know this one, Stacey?
I think they're like a brother and sister, and they're in a band. But I mean, that's all I know. Yeah. I just remember the song, the theme song. So
there
I
were a lot of
up.
Those 80s sort of like Satisfaction and all of those.
Yeah, Eddie and the Cruisers.
Yeah, you're right. A Cleveland brother and sister rise with a rock band while coping with personal problems. Does not specify what kind
Michael
of problem.
Michael J. Fox was everybody's brother.
Yeah, right?
He really was. Stacey, I love that just off the top, you're like, I don't know. It's just, I think it's brother, sister, in a band.
She knows.
You know. All right, 847 says, my movie choice. Maybe I'll Come Home in the Spring.
Yeah.
It has everything. Drugs, hippies, major stars, and over-the-top acting. Sally Field and David Carradine.
TV movie.
Oh.
Yeah. This is great because we're wrapping things up on the 15th with a TV movie. And I found that in researching these things, the further back you go, like in the 70s and 80s, the more bonkers the premise.
Right.
And the more risque the premises were. I mean, this one, no, because I think this is about Sally Field being a hippie. And I mean, there's probably drugs. But the one we're doing is all about the perils of syphilis. And... There are some really like more heavy morality tales that and then you get your stuff like you've got now, the Lifetime movies of, you know, Mother May I Sleep with Danger and stuff, which
there
were
was
90s.
A lot of pagan business too.
Yeah.
On the made for TV front. There was a lot of witchcraft going on mm-hmm. in the '70s on your TV.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
It was the dangers.
Really, really wanted to really push the envelope with the pagan the push.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
The last one here before we go to the break, 815 says The Seven Faces of Dr. Lau,
okay.
1964 film with Tony Randall.
This has got to be a horror film. Do you know this one, Stacey?
No, I don't.
Seven
I was shocked
faces.
To hear Tony Randall, honestly.
I know, right?
The last time we did a movie with Tony Randall in it was My Little Pony, where he voices one of the characters in My Little Pony. He's good. All right. This is Seven Faces of Dr. Lau. This sounds good. A mysterious circus comes to a Western town bearing wonders and characters that entertain the inhabitants and teach valuable lessons. It is billed as a fantasy mystery Western.
Yep.
Oddly, not a circus film. This sounds good. I want to
look into this. All right,
yeah.
We might have, we've piqued the creator's interest. Rachel Clapton.
I love
studio.
The old ones, man. They're
Stephanie
so
Shaw as well, longtime neo-futurist collaborator, and also the director of Suspiria, which
Correct.
Is going to be on stage on Saturday, and also joining us on the line, Stacey Ponder, who's our horror film expert tonight. All right, we'll Excellent. Do this. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back. Joy, you're on the line. There's some other people on the line. There's also a ton more texts we're going to get to.
For you to justify my love,
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Our theme song for Justify Your Love of the best, worst movies of all time. Rachel Claff in studio, the creator of It Came from the Neo Futurarium, the stage reading of the best, worst movies of all time. You can see that every Saturday night through next Saturday, July 15th at 7:30 at the Neo Futurarium up in Andersonville. Stephanie Shaw in studio. She's directing the next one, Suspiria, bringing horror to the stage. So that's coming up here. And also joining us on the line, Stacey Ponder. She used to run the blog Final Girl, and she also, which is about horror movies. And she's done, you dedicate your life to horror, whether it's commissioning art or being a filmmaker. You've been involved with the genre your entire life. So we appreciate you being here to help us out. All right. So we've got some more stuff coming through. I want to get to Joy because she's been on the line. Joy, how you doing, Joy?
Doing good. This is a great great night.
Yeah, right? Okay, so what do you think? What do you got?
I got two. One, since you're talking horror, I don't know if you already mentioned the Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Yeah,
yeah, we talked about that last week.
That's been brought up a couple times, that became sort of the parody version of the Attack movies.
Yeah. And then the one that was in the 90s, I believe, was called North. It was when I had my kids were little, and it was Elijah Wood trying to find better parents and like 20 or 30 different famous people in it is kind of like stereotypical, what would be considered like not appropriate as far as like, oh, what Hawaiian people are like, what Alaskan people are like, what.
Yeah.
And each one had its own quirky stereotypes and a lot of weirdness in it. So,
North,
this is a horror movie then. Okay. It looks it really is packed with people, like famous people. She's right about that.
And so I think I remember the poster. Like, isn't Elijah Wood walking?
He's walking on the earth.
Right. So dumb.
Yeah.
So dumb.
And Bruce Willis is trying to help him. He's like shows up in each thing. And I think it was one of John Ritter's kind of before the end movie.
Yep.
He played the Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie Nelson kind of dad in the movie. So. Anyway,
all the like comedians are in it. John Lovitz is in it. Dan Aykroyd's in it. Jason Alexander's in it.
Abe Vigoda was the Alaskan grandpa that they put out on the ice floe to send him off to his happy place at the end.
Well, that's my role.
No, he's glad to go, and he's like, no, I don't want to leave. You know,
Oh boy.
Twisted.
All right, thanks, Joy.
Have a great night, guys.
Have a great night. That's a good one.
Yeah.
All right. 847 says Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS.
Yes.
Circa 1973. What is that?
It sort of qualifies as a women in prison film, I think. It's like a Nazi exploitation thing. Stacey, do you know this movie?
That's exactly what I would say about it.
Nazi exploitation, if that's a word.
Yeah, it bears all of the hallmarks of the Nazi exploitation genre. Absolutely. Ample Aryan bosoms, you know, ripping other people, you know.
Oh, boy.
847 has the 1972 movie called The Last House on the Left.
That is an early Wes Craven film, and it pretty much set the tone for women, not just in danger, but in really crappy, crummy, down and dirty. It's a disturbing film, and he did it on a shoestring budget with a bunch of friends. None of them are actors, you can tell, and that just makes it all the creepier.
Wow.
Yeah. It is a disturbing film, but very effective.
Yeah. Well, do you put this one in a best worst movies of all time?
I wouldn't call it a best worst. In that it is a difficult watch. It's it's sort of the, you know, scuzzy 70s exploitation version of Bergman's Virgin Spring.
Uh-huh.
So it's like lots of rape, lots of violence. Mm. Like, that's not fun. Yeah.
No,
like
a bad way.
Those are my least favorite horror films.
Those really are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. 708 says the worst horror movie ever, Critters.
Yeah.
Any of them.
It's not good. It's not good.
All right. 773 says, let's move out of the horror genre. Let's go to, I guess this is comedy, Jack and Jill.
Okay. This is one where, and this is one of our rules, the movie, for good, bad movie, has to be inherently somehow rewatchable. I would argue that Jack and Jill is not only not rewatchable, but just not watchable. It's so terrible. Adam Sandler playing his own sister, and it's just so deeply unfunny and painful the whole way through. Just not watchable in the first place. So yeah, we really try to pick stuff that's like, I'd see that again. That was bonkers.
Well, you have to have some likability in how bad it is that you would go back to it. But the idea that something's
enjoyable,
so disturbing
bad,
that you wouldn't want to watch it again.
Yeah. This is one of those ones that fits into the whole sort of legitimately, like, somebody gave this money. Why? I could write a better movie in 5 minutes on an index card.
Someone had a lot of faith in Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
And figured, you know.
Yeah.
All right. I've got a great one for you guys. This is from my buddy Neil, who the 1977 film Viva Knievel.
That's great.
Okay.
Yep.
Here's the synopsis for you. Okay. It is a front runner just on the synopsis.
It really is. Yeah.
Motorcycle stuntman Evil Knievel is offered a fortune to perform in Mexico. What Evil doesn't know is that they're planning to kill him and use his body to ship cocaine into the United States.
Oh, God.
His chief mechanic, who is an alcoholic, is weary of the whole thing and discovers something. But before he can tell Evil, he is sent to a rehab clinic for drug addicts, which Evil doesn't believe he is. He goes to see him, who tells Evil what he found out, but is still in the dark about what is happening.
Oh,
wow, that's not only a bad movie, but a terrible summary, too.
It's really wonderful because, well, and then you have to remember, too, I haven't seen it, but Evel Knievel is by no means an actor, so I can't imagine that wasn't anything but painful.
Wait, was it starring the actual Evel Knievel?
I'm assuming.
Oh, it's got
I would
to
assume
be.
It is,
yeah,
right?
1977? Yeah, because they used his name, 77,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. It wasn't just some actor in a belt buckle and a jumpsuit.
No.
Okay.
Also, the phrase, what evil doesn't know, sounds like its own horror movie, may I say.
It's a pretty great cover to it as well. It's him jumping.
Over something. Mm-hmm. But then it turns into mysteriously Weekend at Bernie's meets, what's the drug movie from the 2000s?
Midnight Express.
I don't know.
What drug movie from the 2000s?
You know what I'm thinking.
All of them?
All of them.
I will say this. My buddy Neil, when I told him, he used to work for Troma.
Yeah.
And he also worked at Facets.
Oh, okay.
So he loves this. He loves this game. He loves everything about it. Loves the series. Mm-hmm. And he told me, he's like, Bad Ronald, I have a copy of that.
Yeah.
And he said that the one that has eluded him has been Rabbit Test.
Okay.
Because with Billy Crystal getting pregnant, which 1 week two, he said, I can't find, I have to look for it, try to get a VHS, try to order. It's just not available. He's like, I've never come across a copy of that. And I've tried.
I might still have Joan Rivers' autograph from when I went to go see that in Arlington Heights at the Arlington Theater.
That's amazing.
When I was 12, I stood in line and I got Joan Rivers. She stopped into Arlington Heights.
Wow.
For the premiere.
For the premiere.
Rabbit Test.
Wow, there you go.
I'm sure I have it in a box somewhere.
That's
amazing.
Yeah,
wow, see? All right, we're on to something here. We're getting closer.
Well, that's a mission.
At 12, I really thought it was an enjoyable film. At 12, I dug it.
All right, back to the genre. 224 says Wrong Turn is my vote.
Yeah, that's cannibals. Yeah. It's just your teens in peril thing, right?
You can't go wrong with cannibals.
So good.
Is it? Yeah.
It's so good. It's enjoyable.
How does it rate among the cannibal films? There's a lot of cannibal films.
It's very highly rated, in its respective subgenre. Okay. Absolutely. Okay.
All right. So Rebecca De Mornay, who has shown up on our list before.
Sure.
Simmons says, 312 says, The Slugger's Wife.
The Slugger's Wife. I looked this up. It's a baseball legend meets a nightclub singer, sort of a drama. I don't know. Baseball. Look, Rebecca De Mornay is kind of the queen of some real stinkers.
Okay.
We've threatened to do Hand That Rocks the Cradle several times. We haven't done it yet, but I am waiting.
All right. There's a lot of movies here, and I'm going to go through them real quick here. All right. So, well, you know what we'll do? We'll take a break. We got one break here. 312-981-7200. Patrick's on the line. We've got a bunch of texts that are coming in. Wow, a lot of people like this game, and we're going to name one of these movies to be the winner tonight.
It's going to be a hard one tonight.
And it is going to be a tough one. Yeah. Rachel Claff in studio, also Stephanie Shaw. Stacey Ponder on the phone. We will continue the conversation and also pick the winner coming up after the break. Stay with us. It's a download. They're justifying our love for the best, worst movies of all time. 312-981-7200. Rachel Claff in studio. She's the creator of It Came from the Neo Futurarium, the summer series at the Neo Futurarium that staged readings.
Yep. 12th year.
Best, worst movies of all time. 12th year on stage for the 15th. Saturdays at 7:30. Coming up this Saturday, Suspiria. Directed by Stephanie Shaw, who's also in studio. Stephanie, are you prepared? Are you ready? I mean, it's Thursday. Are you feeling it?
I had the Cairo syrup and the red food dye and the chocolate sauce, and I mixed them up in a jar, and I've been painting things all day.
I looked for my nightgown, by the way.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I'm also in this film.
You're in this one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rachel's in it. Yeah. Rachel's playing the Italian best friend.
Yeah, and I'm biased, but I have some decent death scenes.
Okay.
Like, well, really good ones.
Oh, all right.
She gets two death scenes.
I do.
How do we do that?
Well, you have to find out on
the
Saturday.
The magic of staged reading
the
cinema.
The Neo-Futurarium up at Foster and Ashland. Great place. All right. On the phone as well, Stacey Ponder. Her blog, it's no longer, it's Final Girl, about horror films. Also, really lives a life around horror films. Commissions art, also was an indie filmmaker. So Stacey has been here with us tonight to give us a better understanding on which horror films are the worst.
That's you know, right. I would like, can I make a nomination? Can I make a
sure,
nomination
of
my own for this? Okay. There's a film called Kathy's Curse, which came out, I think, 1977. It's about a young girl who is possessed by the vengeful spirit of her aunt who died like 30 years previously. And it's sort of the filmmakers said, you know, hey, you know, The Exorcist is popular, Carrie's popular, and The Omen is popular, so let's just blend them all together into one really terrible film. And it's, you know, the acting is atrocious, the effects are ridiculous, but the dialogue is the key.
Oh, I bet it's great.
Nice, okay.
Oh, it's like, all right, listen, it's George, you know, and I know that I've had a nervous breakdown, all right, but it's not catching. It's just like, it is so entertaining.
All right, let's
it's
go.
So good.
Let's do this. Let's go to the lines. Get the callers in, and then we'll do the rest of the texts that are in. Let's go to Mario. Mario, justify your love for the best worst movie of all time. What do you got?
I have a doozy for all of you in there. It's called The Puma Man. It's like early 80s, like really late 70s, 79, 80, somewhere around there.
Okay.
And it's just terrible, but this movie kicks it twice. Not only that the acting and the story is bad, it's also got a theme song that once you hear it, honest to God, you will not get it out of your head.
I could see Zimmerman already the wheels churning.
It's like they're playing it on a...
Is this it?
Oh my God.
Oh, this is beautiful.
Oh my God, please shut it off. I'm telling you, you'll hum it the whole night through.
I'm putting this on my playlist for when I jog.
Oh my God, it's just horrible. It's horrible.
Wow.
I think some Italian company made it.
The Puma Man. Okay.
Is he
the
a puma?
Puma Man.
Does he turn? Is he a... what's the...
No. The story goes that some aliens came from somewhere and they dropped off, get this, a mask. And seriously, it's like a golden mask, and whoever possesses the mask and puts it on like a pedestal and looks through it can control minds.
Oh, sure.
Classic.
Right. And there's only one man. There's actually one man in a whole wide world that could that can stop it, because the aliens also gave this guy the power of a puma.
Well, of course.
And he learns to walk through walls, and he can fly, he can jump.
As pumas do.
Yeah.
Off of buildings. It is the worst thing I ever see.
Oh.
Wow, Mario, man.
Mario just sold that.
You might have won the whole thing.
Yeah,
right,
just out of sheer charm.
I'm telling you, it's the song. It's the song that does it, though. if you watch
even...
it and you listen, and it's constant through the whole damn movie.
It's horrible. It sounds like... I don't even know. It sounds like a bad video game.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
A children's Saturday morning sort of romp.
Yep.
Thank you.
Oh,
all right,
God, it's
Mario,
awful.
I'm putting you on hold. Oh. Mario, don't hang up. Don't hang up.
Okay.
All right, I'm putting you on hold. Mario gets a pizza.
Yeah, Mario
that was,
gets
that,
a pizza.
That's how
that
you played
beautiful.
That game.
Oh.
There was audio visual in that.
And he was actively horrified when we started playing that song.
Yeah.
That was great radio, and Mario gets a pizza for it. I haven't. None of us have seen the Puma Man.
No, and I don't care. No. I would listen to. All I really want to do is just sit next to Mario and have him describe it to me.
While that
music plays. That's fine by me. We'll put it on stage, Mario. I'm not even kidding.
That was pretty good, man. That was pretty good. All right. The other movies that showed up tonight, I want to find this. 708, Rick says the best worst movie is a film called Liquid Sky.
Okay.
Came out in the 80s, centered around heroin and aliens. They're always aliens.
Yeah, I think the aliens come in search of the heroin, or they have the heroine. Yeah, it's not. It's like a psychosexual romp.
The cast is comprised of unknowns except for a model named Anne Carlisle. Yeah. It's so bad it's good.
Yeah.
There you go. 224 says Hot Tub Time Machine. I don't know. That's all right.
You know,
we're not the audience for it, but I don't know if that means it's bad.
It's just silly.
312 says the original Toxic Avenger movie.
I don't know that one.
No.
That's a trauma movie. So there's oh, it's trauma. That line.
Yeah, right.
Did you say Frozen Assets? Because I've got
Frozen
the,
Assets. I've yes, Frozen the, Assets was next. Yeah,
this is good on the synopsis alone. Zach Shepard, played by Corbin Berenson, is excited to find he's been hired as president of a bank. When he finally arrives, he discovers to his dismay that the bank is actually a sperm bank. There he meets the cold Dr. Grace Murdoch, played by Shelley Long, and her, of course, they fall in love. Mm-hmm.
It's a sperm bank and she's cold.
Here's how much it made. I don't know why my phone is telling me this, but it made $376,008.
There you go. That's a good return.
Aw, poor Shelley Long.
All right. So 312 says the early 80s karate movie, Kill and Kill Again.
Oh. That doesn't sound like it has anything to do with karate.
No.
But...
270 says Puma Man is a great Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Oh, that's another Mystery Science Theater. Okay.
847 says Monolith Monsters.
I don't know that one either.
I don't know that one.
I bet that sounds old.
Okay. Movie from the 1950s, 270 says This Island Earth.
Oh, that sounds familiar. But I really like the real old stuff. Those are my favorites to stage because they're real gems.
All right. This is 815 also does it right because we're getting these kind of, and it's on me because I didn't reiterate at the top, just throwing out a name of a movie at us. That's not going to make it happen. This is how you do it. 815 says, the movie Tusk, T-U-S-K.
Just came out.
A guy abducts another guy and tries to turn him into a walrus.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Supposedly based on a true story.
That's I think it's a Kevin, what's his name?
Smith.
Kevin Smith movie, right?
Yeah. Oh, it is?
It's very recent.
It's very recent. I think it's last year.
It's one of those that I sort of have stayed away from because I never could quite find the correct mood to watch it.
Yeah.
I'm just like, no, I don't think I want to watch a guy turn another guy into a walrus tonight.
All right. Before we have the finalists here for this week, Suspiria. One more time, Stephanie. Tell us about what the movie is and why we should go on Saturday to see you guys stage read it.
I mean, you can't lose. It's got witches. It's got dancers. It's got maggots. Yep. it's about beautiful young Susie Banyan, an American who goes to Freiburg to study dance and discovers a coven of witches is running her dance academy.
And the dance academy is
just rife with issues, including Joan Bennett in her last role. And having watched and rewatched the movie, we've all decided she's just waiting for her drink at the end of the shoot.
Yeah.
She's just she's saying the stuff.
And dripping with jewels.
And dripping. And she looks great.
You've got to go see Suspiria Saturday night, 7:30 at the Neo Futurarium up at Foster National. All right. So we like we said, we're giving away a Lou Malnati's gift certificate tonight. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. We gave one away already to Mario.
Yeah, spontaneously because it was just so great.
It's so good, right? So that
Puma
we'll take that one off. So what we have tonight is we have four movies.
Yeah.
That and really which could be down to three, but we have Viva Knievel, which is the movie about Evel Knievel going
just
to Mexico.
On the description alone.
They want to kill him
and stuff him
stuff
him
his
with
body
cocaine.
Right?
I believe it was who called this one in. Harold did. The Incredible Melting Man.
Uh-huh. Yep.
About a guy who gets too close to the sun, and it not only melts him, but it makes him want to kill.
A killer, yeah.
Sure.
We've got Light of Day, which all we have on Light of Day is it's a brother-sister band
Joan
movie
Jett.
With Joan Jett and Michael J. Fox.
I just like that pairing.
Yeah.
And then the final, Kathy's Curse, which is Stacey's late entry into the best worst. So why don't we go? I mean, what do you like? Let's go to Pete Zimmerman. I think Pete has been listening along. He's up. What do you like, Pete? I mean, since we're kind of torn between Viva Knievel, The Incredible Melting Man, Light of Day, or Kathy's Curse.
You know, I kind of like Viva Knievel because I was looking at the cast, and you know, we can talk about Evel Knievel all you want, but it has Gene Kelly as the other star.
Of course what? It does.
Gene Kelly. And I like click. I was like, is this some other Gene Kelly? But no, it's the Gene Kelly.
Okay, and if this is 1977, he's got 3 more years until he makes Xanadu, and then he's done.
And according to the plot, Knievel prepares for another one of his stunt jumps, and we are introduced to his alcohol mechanic, Will Atkins, played by Gene Kelly.
Oh, it's Gene Kelly's playing the alcoholic mechanic. This is good stuff.
All right, well, then that's going to win. That's going to win. Viva Knievel.
No.
Also stars the late Frank Gifford.
Frank Gifford?
Oh, for goodness sake.
Wow. This is amazing.
This
all
is
right,
getting
we
more
got it. Viva Knievel
compelling.
Wins tonight to add to the mix. We're going to have to put together some sort of festival for this.
Well, look, Viva Knievel, I have somebody in mind that I'm going to need to talk to about that one.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. All right, Rachel Claff, Stephanie Shaw, Stacey Ponder, thank you all for playing this week. Justifying
pleasure.
Your love for the worst, best worst movies of all time. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank
you. So fun.
All right. This is Chicago's very own 720, WGN Chicago, WGNradio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. That was so much fun. Wow. We are down to, we only have, what, one left here?
One left?
Oh, man, that's no good. So we're going to come out of here with 5. And then we got to do one more and just have the 5 and have people vote for it or something like that. We'll figure
it out.
Oh,
yeah, you can do like a bracket.
Yeah, a bracket. So we got to do a bracket.
Did anybody say Howard the Duck?
Howard the Duck. That's a great movie.
It's terrible. Oh.
It's terrible.
And I saw it twice.
Don't. Nobody should have. No.
And I saw it twice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. All right.
Who didn't? In the
I think I saw it. Yeah, I feel like I've seen it like 5 times. I'm with you, Rob.